We'll call the Health and Human Services Division to order for Friday, March 28th. This is expected to be our last hearing to hear bills before rolling out the articles for the omnibus finance bill for this year. We have Senator Goodwin was here and didn't have Senate File 1998's fiscal note ready for us. We laid it on the table. It's not on the agenda, but we're going to pick that up and take a quick look at the fiscal note and get that processed. Senator Goodwin. But we've already heard testimony in the presentation of the bill. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. We have changed the bill because we could not get a fiscal note that.
So you've got an amendment.
I haven't seen a fiscal note yet. So
A3 amendment.
Right. The A3 amendment is a delete everything. There's a few changes in there, and I'll just tell you what they are. This is the working group that we're going to establish to study and report back next January on developing some kind of alternatives to putting people with mental illness in jails and prisons. So here I'll tell you what the changes are. We've said that the Commissioner of Human Services may convene instead of shall convene a working group. And then we also said that the commissioner shall enter into agreement with NAMI, Minnesota, to carry out the work of the working group. NAMI has generously decided that, you know, if we couldn't get this done through our own human services department, we could get it done with NAMI's help. And then in the membership, we're adding community corrections staff and administrative issues. We put in there that NAMI Minnesota shall provide meeting space and administrative support to the working group, and that the commissioner may solicit in-kind support from work group member agencies to accomplish its assigned goals. Originally, we had both corrections and DHS working together on this issue, which we really hoped to achieve, but we had some outrageous fiscal notes that we couldn't deal with. So we brought it down to human services, and then we never got a fiscal note. So now we've got a bill here that we think we can get done with the help of the people.
And so, Senator Goodwin, you with this, I understand there's zero fiscal
with
note.
With this, there's zero fiscal
okay.
note, Mr.
And
Chair.
And you still expect both corrections and DHS to be actively engaged in this process,
Thank
correct?
You, Mr. Chair. Absolutely.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Senator Brown moves the A3 amendment on that. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Any further discussion on the bill? Anyone else from the audience wish to offer testimony in support or opposition to Senate File 1998? Seeing none, Senator Brown moves Senate File 1998 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS articles to the finance omnibus. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator
Thank
Goodwin.
Thank you very much.
Has Senator
That's
Cohen showed up yet? I think so. So, Senator Marty, welcome to the committee. Senate File 1718.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We do want to strike Section 1 of the bill, and I believe you have another amendment that we wanted as well.
Senator Marty has a couple of author's amendments to bring the bill into the shape he wishes. The first is an oral amendment to strike Section 1. Is that correct, Senator
That's
Marty?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
On Senator Marty's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And then, Senator Marty, you have an A1 author's
yes,
amendment.
Yes, but actually, Mr. Chair, I can't move them because I'm not on your committee. But
well, then Senator Franzen moved
Thank
the
you.
Oral amendment. I'm so used to having you in the health committee. Oh, it's like old times. So the Senator Marty has the A1 author's amendment as well. Senator Franzen moves the A1 author's amendment. Mm. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Marty, you have the bill in shape.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And the state has, for a number of years, been cutting funding for community mental health services and need for supportive housing, and with this new amendment, ICHRS, the intensive community rehab services, really, they're cost-saving programs. They're really valuable. In the packet, you'll see the supportive housing. I think the packet you received has a chart, and I believe this was from a program with only 650 people in it, and you see there's a grid that shows how many people, how many hospitalizations there were for that small program the year before and the year after, a difference of almost 3,300 hospital bed days dropping to 630 days. You can see when you figure the number of people providing supportive housing for how much just the savings from inpatient hospital beds cost is. They're big cost savings, and the most important thing is it makes a real difference in people's lives. I'd like to just turn it over to Sue Abderholden.
Ms. Abderholden, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. The adult mental health block grants, frankly, have received lots of cuts over the years. In 2010, it was $12.7 million. In 2011, it was $13 million. Last legislative session, you took funds, a little over $6 million to actually fix the ARMS services where we had lost providers. So it's one of those things that, frankly, block grants over here become more difficult to protect because we don't necessarily have the data and the reporting and the outcomes so that we can actually protect those funds. So we thought maybe, in moving forward that we need to actually set aside some dollars for specific things that we know everybody needs. One of them is supportive housing. When you look at the needs reports from counties around the state, everyone says we need supportive housing. We actually think that will undo the logjam that we face where people are stuck at Anoka, for example, or stuck in corporate foster care settings. So we think that will help. And the ICHRS program we kind of refer to as ACT Light. So it's assertive community treatment teams, but in rural Minnesota, it's more difficult to bring in enough people to really follow the true ACT model. ICHRS also prevents hospitalizations. It helps people live well in the community. So I think both programs we know are very effective. We need to make sure that we have funding available for those. I will say that counties do have maintenance of effort dollars that they have to, keep in the mental health system. Those dollars do provide them the flexibility. We have talked with MAXA and the department about really meeting this summer to figure out, is there a better way to really frame these dollars so that we can, frankly, protect our community mental health dollars in the future. We have two people here today that wanted to just briefly share their story with supportive housing and ICHRS, and the first person is Terrence.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and provide your insights.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Terrence Laceville, and I'm currently an inpatient at People Incorporated HUS program. I've been there since January the 14th, 2014, and I was getting real good care there, but then I started noticing people that have been there and they were getting ready to leave, get discharged, and they got discharged to the streets. And I've been in contact with a lot of them, and they're not doing so good. So as a result of that, I'm getting ready to get discharged soon, and I'm starting to get off of the treatment that they're offering me because I'm thinking about and worrying about where I'm going to go. It's not a good feeling. And a few people I talked to, they were sent to, I'm not trying to down any other places, but they were sent to certain shelters that they was telling me, informing me it was drug infested and stuff. So I'm not trying to go to places like that, seeing the life that I lived. I just want to better my chances, when I leave the HUS program at People Incorporated and not be sent to the streets, because it's not very healthy for a person like me. I just would like a better chance to get the help I need. And I know all the streets is not going to help me. And that's all I really wanted to share with you all.
Thank you for coming to share your story, Mr. Laceville, is it?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. And one more testifier?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Allison Hagan, and I'm a client of Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center ICRS program in Rochester, Minnesota since 2010. I began working with the ICRS team after 90 days in a mental health treatment facility in Zumbro Valley, and they had placed me into adult foster care. The ICRS worker helped me with the paperwork and find the care that I would need, doctors and supports with the community. The team helped me learn to do basic things that I struggled with, budgeting, dealing with conflicts, the joys of interpersonal relationships, family and friends, and they encouraged me to maintain healthy boundaries and relationships and find hobbies in my life to kind of more fulfill me. During my recovery, I was often ended up in the mental health unit at Mayo Clinic. During this time, the ICRS team stayed in contact with me, visited, and had constant communication with the staff at Mayo to kind of collaborate my care. In 2013, August, I began doing electric convulsive therapy. And the whole time, I was terrified, but I knew that ICRS was behind me, and they helped manage my treatments, appointments, questions. Even during this time, my daughter was about to begin her first day of kindergarten 30 miles away, and I was not able to drive, but my ICRS worker actually took me to my daughter's house and to her school so that I could be there for her first day. Anytime that I had an issue with my physical or mental health or any other problem in my life, the ICRS was there to help guide me through the situation. When they didn't know what to do or how to handle something, they always found an answer, and we all worked together and made it work. In 2013, I decided that I was going to begin an education, and I wanted to work in the field of psychology because of my experience with the ERTS program and the ICRS team. She was able to help me figure out the details and point me in the direction of the resources I would need. She went with me to meet with the Workforce Center to set up a plan to begin school and how to work with the Ticket to Work program and other programs that I would need. When I became anxious, stressed, doubtful, the ICRS team was there to encourage and support me the whole time. Fast forwarding to today, I'll be graduating with an Associate's Degree of Human Services, and I was accepted to Metro State University to begin a Bachelor's of Psychology. I also plan on completing a Master's Degree to become a mental health practitioner and be able to give back in such ways. For the past year, I've maintained a 4.0 GPA while taking full-time courses. I'm also involved in NAMI. Be teaching a program to teenagers who struggle with mental illness how to cope and manage. Because of the ICRS program, I'm able to make and maintain stable and safe relationships with family and friends. I can set and maintain boundaries. I have control over my anxiety and can stabilize and maintain my moods. I finally have a healthy lifestyle. I am strong, confident, excited, and happy with life. I am able to be the mother to my daughter that I never thought would be possible. I've worked extremely hard with the ICRS team to become the person that I am today, and every day feels like a dream come true, no matter how bad the day may have been. I truly believe that today I wouldn't be where I was without the support of the ICRS team. They were the first team and the first people in my life who really came together to fully support me on every situation, whether it was good or bad. They would be right there to back me up, and without them, I don't know where I would be today, so I'm eternally grateful for that opportunity.
Ms. Hagen, thank you for having the courage to come tell your story as well. It really does make a difference and helps us understand the importance of some of these services that helped you get to a better place. And congratulations on your recovery and your successes to date. We look forward to hearing much more as you progress in your education and begin to help others. It's really meaningful. And members, you provided testimony that sounded like the story I read this morning before the committee, and it moved me. So thank you for that. Any questions of members? Seeing none, anyone in the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1718? Seeing none, Senator Franzen moves that Senate File 1718, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS articles for the Finance Omnibus. On that motion, Senator Sharon.
Thank you. This particular appropriation really is in response to continual reductions in these grants. And as Ms. Abderholden said, that they've articulated all the cuts to these grants. And what this effort is to restore some of that money, but to target it to a very specific purpose. And my comments are not to dismiss the fact that that particular purpose is absolutely important and useful in terms of stabilizing people and preventing higher level of hospitalization or need of services. But my counties have contacted me. They've been very distressed.
Yep.
And are distressed to the tune of about $500,000 cut from their budget for services that they used to provide through these grants in the region, in the rural part of the state. And what they want this legislature to understand is that by narrowing the focus of this, although we can achieve an objective of identifying specifically how the money is utilized, which is one of the issues of trying to hold on to this money that Ms. Abderholden talked about. For my counties and for many rural counties, it is the grants and their capacity to develop their own specific project that fits within the needs of their region, that it would be more helpful to them. So when this gets narrowed to a housing specific, it doesn't necessarily align with what the priority would be in Nicollet or Brown or Blue Earth County. So their request, they're not here to testify, but have communicated with me in writing that this money not, although they support the money, they would like the money to be articulated in a way that allows for project specific, that the department can distribute the money for projects that are specifically designed for the regions in which the services are being provided. So I'm wondering if there's something that we can do to consider that further in the future.
Senator Sharon, I think that the A1 amendment was an attempt to address the issues that your counties came in and talked to us about. It funds the intense, I think it is the ICRS, the Intensive Community Rehab Services. And as Ms. Abderholden, that they're looking for, as Mr. Abderholden explained, these are kind of a rural model of an ACT team, an assertive community treatment team, where there just isn't the population of needing help to support a fully blown ACT team. You wind up overstressing the employees of an ACT team. So this is a ACT light kind of that was developed by rural and has worked very well, as we just heard from Ms. Hagen. And I think that's the piece that was most damaging to the Nicollet County representatives that came in, and the A4 amendment put that specific allocation in, I believe. Senator Ms. Abderholden, is that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, yes, the rural counties really wanted the ICRS dollars. But I also want to say that it's wonderful if we can give money to counties and give them the flexibility to do that, but we haven't been able to sustain that. And last year when the money was transferred, there was the idea that since more people would get coverage with Medicaid expansion and stuff, that the counties would have fewer dollars that they would have to actually pay for treatment, and that would give them the flexibility with their own dollars to meet those other needs. But as someone who fights very hard for mental health funding, it has been nearly impossible, frankly, to not even get cuts to the mental health grants, but to increase them. And so I always figure if I can get some money at least for things that we know are needs, that's better than nothing. And that's kind of how...
A little bit of extra context as well, if I could. So last year, it was... a reduction of the grants, which are state-only dollars, matched some with county maintenance of effort required by the state. But it was a pulling in of those and creating additional Medicaid services that would allow us to draw down additional federal money and hopefully fill the gaps. As it's rolled out, not all of the gaps have been filled. We're seeing some of them. This is an attempt to try to mitigate some of that. But, we turned the $6 million of grants into $10 million when we matched it with federal and tried to get it back out on the street. So, it was, a valuable approach, but it left some things undone, and that's the purpose of this bill, is to try to mitigate some of that as well. But again, with state-only dollars, no federal share anticipated to go along with these state grants, and that's something that maybe we can look at over time. Two is trying to draw down some federal money to support this rural approach to a really critical core mental health service that really helps people. And it's something that we haven't been able to do as of yet. It is what was behind that, repurposing of the $6 million. I hesitate to call it a cut. It was taking that six and turning it into 10 and trying to meet those needs.
Senator Laurie, I understand that we constantly are looking, and I really appreciate the department's looking to see where we can maximize federal dollars, draw those down, and in order to capture those, we had to take money away from a grant program that ever since we've done that, I've heard from my counties in my district and that it was the flexibility of those grant programs that allowed them what is really important to remember in this, whether we were talking about non-emergency medical transportation or talking about how to distribute mental health dollars. The needs are different in various parts of the state. And what I think my counties are saying is that that they're not speaking against the need for housing. They're speaking to the fact that regions should be able to, when if dollars are going to be committed towards mental health services to, for the goal of redirecting people away from high-cost care, that it might be better for the counties to articulate what that specific here it's a very specific utilization. It's decided here what it should be used for. And what our counties are saying is you really ought to allow us to make our proposals, our pilots, our projects, present them to the department for these dollars rather than have it be defined someplace else. So that I just need to communicate that concern because, and when we do this, for example, in the area of housing, and although there's been this amendment, we ought to track and see where that's actually spent. I mean, we talk about it as though we're going to resolve a generalized issue related to just an overwhelming amount of need for housing, for mental health services. That there's not anybody more of an advocate for that in this legislature than me. Many who are as big of advocates for it, but not more of an advocate. But my voice here is not opposed to that. It's about recognizing that what looks like we're solving a problem may not, in fact, be designed in a model or a methodology that helps, rural parts of the state. And that's all I'll say about it.
And, Mr. Chair, it's some of the strongest advocates for mental health services the conflict because there is the shortage. And I think that's why we wanted to have the ICARS program included as well, because I think we want them to have the flexibility to do it. I think, we're just very hopeful that the committee can find some funds for addressing these critical needs.
On Senator Franzen's motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Senator Martin.
Senator Cohen. Senate file 2692. The mini mines, is that right? Yeah, isn't it? Senator Cohen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Senate File 2692 is a bill which deals with early education, deals with an expansion of what we're doing with that. Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that this division would like to hear the relevant sections which deal with the pilot project for home visiting and utilization of child care providers. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, members, what is proposed is to take our early childhood program to the next level and make sure that not only in dealing with children at the youngest level in terms of the scholarship program, that we take it a step forward or backwards, to the extent that an attempt is made to deal with families with infant children that don't otherwise have access to a lot of the preschool kinds of programs. Obviously, if we're dealing with children at that level, at say a 0-2 level, we're dealing with kids who are not going to. You know, they might be in a daycare setting, but in terms of the families, most in need and most at risk, we don't have any intensive programs to deal with them. So what this does is it sets up a pilot project to allow for home visiting, looking at children in at highest risk, using the families that are getting assistance through the MFIP program. and allows then through that pilot to make sure there's a report back, if the pilot is established, to make sure there's a report back to the appropriate committees. It also deals with making sure that we have, you know, licensed providers who can deal appropriately, that we're not dealing with, sound facetious, but folks off the street in doing this. We're dealing with people who are trained to provide this kind of high quality care, and then attempt to do what this legislature has begun over the last several years to deal with the youngest children in terms of getting them ready to learn in a substantive way once they are now of an age in a program at a certain level in school. And I think the information, the studies, the metrics we have relative to the impact of early childhood on children at all levels is significant and shows that if we can begin to work with those children, we actually can have an impact so that as kids get into the third, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth grades, they're ready for a secondary school experience and to do so in a way that's going to be meaningful. I have other legislation. In fact, I have, just parenthetically, Mr. Chairman, one bill that has been heard in the education committees that deals with kids at the secondary level in terms of getting them ready to go to college from the same type of background. And if we can do something more intensive, I think clearly, as I mentioned, what we have by way of metrics shows that this really pays off. So I've got a couple of folks to testify as to what's been going on with this, and maybe should let them offer some testimony to the committee.
Who wishes to start? Ms. Caldwell? Welcome to the committee. State your name for
Thank
the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Patricia Caldwell, and I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Targeted Home Visiting, which is composed of, it's an organization pretty loosely knit that's composed of local public health departments, Head Start, early childhood family education, and a wide range of nonprofit social services organizations throughout the state. We are also part of the Many Minds Coalition, which supports a comprehensive approach to early childhood development and education. And we certainly appreciate Senator Cohen including home visiting in his bill. I'm going to give just a little bit of information about home visiting, who is seen through those services and why it's important, and then just talk about particularly the sections that pertain to the pieces of legislation that we're proposing. That would be Section 4, Subdivision 1, and Subdivision 2. So a little bit of background. Minnesota children who experience economic hardships, maltreatment, and other trauma face distinct risks to their overall development. For example, in Minnesota, 13.7% of pregnant women received inadequate or late prenatal care, the second or third trimester only. 15.2% of pregnant women smoked during pregnancy, and 4.3% per 100,000 children, 12 years and older are abused and neglected. As probably you know, research that's been done on adverse childhood experiences, ACEs, indicates that children who experience trauma in those areas are less ready to learn, they become less likely to become gainfully employed, and more likely to experience poor health outcomes later in life. Evidence-based voluntary home visiting has been shown to be an effective service strategy for very young children and their families, improving outcomes in lifelong health and well-being, school readiness, and economic self-sufficiency. In fact, research-based home visiting models have shown that for every public dollar invested, a return of up to $5.70 can be expected in savings to programs. So home visiting is a service strategy to provide parenting support to high-risk families in order to help children succeed in school and life. Targeted home visiting, we see it as part of a continuum of early childhood services, which could include child care, Head Start, and early intervention, and some of those items are also covered in Senator Cohen's bill. What we have, in fact, in this state right now is a number of different kinds of organizations that provide home visiting. Local public health departments have done this for many years. Some social services departments have done it in terms of dealing with potential child maltreatment. Early childhood family education has done a little bit. Head Start has done a little bit. We have all these different kinds of entities. And what we're seeing as we're learning more about brain development and about the potential cost-effective benefits of home visiting is that it would be really helpful to move these things into more of a system that had a common set of outcomes and standards that they could all strive for, a common set of data to be collected, and just a way of sharing research. And so that's what Subdivision 1 does, and you do have an amendment. Do you want me to deal with that now?
Senator Cohen, we have the 8-2 amendment in our packets.
Okay. I'm going to hold on that for a little bit. It talks about establishing a consistent set of standards, development, comprehensive training and competency building, and a coordinated intake of system of intake and service delivery. And we think those are the things that would try to mesh these different kinds of organizations while they'd continue to do the work through their organizations into more of a system so we can say more about the effectiveness of those programs. So that's what Subdivision 1 is. Subdivision 2 would expand an MFIP pilot that was begun last year that a couple of different counties worked on to one rural and one urban county, and that's dealing with very high-risk parents and helping coordinate health and social services for them through home visiting programs. So those are the two elements that are in this bill. It's a pretty small ask in terms of the total amount of the bill, but we think in terms of positioning us to provide effective services and perhaps be able to garner additional resources in the future, that it would be very helpful. So I am going to stop here and let the other testifier, who actually is a client who has received home visiting services, talk a little bit about what that has meant to her.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yes. My name is Andrea Berrano Robinson, B-E-J-A-R-A-N-O hyphen Robinson. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm a parent of three children, 7, 4, and 1, and I came into the program in Dakota County through Dakota County Healthy Families. And when I came in, just to give you a little background of who I am, I was adopted from Colombia, South America, to a mid-level Caucasian family. I am, of course, Latin, and so my father was very abusive to my mother and to his adopted children. So when I became pregnant, I was very worried about repeating what I had seen in my childhood. So when this opportunity came to me, I took it because I understood that you aren't necessarily going to be your past. If you can choose to work on yourself and to make sure that you don't repeat your past. And so when this opportunity came and the home visitor came as I was pregnant and we talked about parenting strategies and what does that look like, that was very helpful for me. Because I was a nervous Nelly, if you will, as a new parent. And so when I had to move counties, I became nervous again because I wanted to continue the service that I was receiving. I was finding great knowledge in the service that I was receiving through the Dakota Healthy Family Program. And when I told them what county I was moving into, they became excited and said, oh, we're just starting this program in Hennepin County, and great, you'll be able to transfer. So I transferred without problems and started the service again, just continuing on. So it was very smooth transfer. And I have to say that is the most important thing to any family that is moving from one county to another, is the transition piece of that. And if this is this bill is passed forward, that would give other counties the opportunity to have this model. And this model works. I have I've been able to restrain many of my past issues, and so I'm very thankful for the service providers that came into my home. I'm glad they looked beyond my messy house and was able to help me. and I really think that this model would work statewide, and that any families that have had past that questionable would really benefit from this program. I'm now a self-advocate, and I have everybody to thank, and especially the home visiting program, because without them, I don't think I would be as successful a parent as I am now with the knowledge that I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Yarano Robinson. It's good to have you here. Senator Cohen, any other testifiers?
I don't believe so. Mr. Hagee is here. I didn't see him as I walked in.
Mr. Hagee, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Morning, members. My name is Eric Hagee with AFSCME Council 5. Thanks for this opportunity to testify today in support of Senate File 2692 and to Senator Cohen for bringing this proposal forward. Want to draw your attention in particular to the funding in the bill for quality improvements for family child care providers in Section 4, Subdivision 3. This is an important piece of the bill supporting Minnesota's 12,000 family child care providers as Parent Aware begins to go statewide next year. The bill specifically invests $2.75 million in a variety of methods aimed at helping providers improve their quality, hoping to reach approximately 350 providers. We hope this will build a solid picture of the resources necessary for providers at different levels of quality to participate in Parent Aware and improve their quality. One of the key components of the funding would go to supporting mentoring and coaching efforts, which focuses on working with individual providers at their own pace and building on their own strengths as they work through Parent Aware and to make other quality improvements. Because family providers are often their own entity, isolated from other providers, mentors can play a valuable role in navigating the quality documentation that's required in Parent Aware, whether it's implementing a parent engagement strategy or building a curriculum with the appropriate materials. Providers we have worked with have recounted to me how valuable mentoring has been to them as they go through the journey of Parent Aware. This funding would be one more tool in the toolbox to incentivize providers to enroll in Parent Aware, adding to tiered reimbursement for CCAP that just went into effect this month, and the expansion of the early learning scholarships, which is one of our top priorities this session. We hope the committee will look favorably on this bill as it considers its funding priorities this year. As we know, money invested in providers' improvements has long-reaching effects far into the future. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions about this, and Ann McCauley from Child Care Aware is here that can go into more detail about mentoring and coaching. Thanks.
Senator Cohen?
Mr. Chairman, you started to mention that there is an A2 amendment.
Yes.
I don't know if this might be an appropriate time to consider the amendment. Ms. Caldwell started to testify to the amendment, which puts the language of Subdivision 1 in better shape. This bill has been through several committees, so this would not be an author's amendment.
Right.
There is, on the amendment, one small change. There's a bit of redundant phrasing, if members might be willing to allow that to be incorporated, on line 1.6 to strike the words research and so it would read on evidence-based research. So it must be based on evidence-based research, and if it might be possible to incorporate that in the proposed amendment. Ms. Caldwell can offer some her testimony went over how this language works. It just, again, puts Subdivision 1 in better shape, in more comprehensive shape. I don't know if you'd like to have further discussion on the amendment. But
I think she described it as we went through. Okay. And we've got both pieces. Senator Franzen moves the A2 amendment as orally amended. On that, any further questions of members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Any further testimony? Any questions of members for these testifiers? Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment, and Ms. White's going to help me with it. She has my bill language. There's a section on grants to child care providers. I believe the number is $2.75 million.
Yep.
And what I would like to do is make sure that those grants go to the providers who are serving the most at-risk families. And I'm going to be blunt. The mom who provides licensed family child care down the street from me and serves largely stable families, doesn't need the grant as much as maybe a child care provider who serves the youngest, most at-risk children that we refer to in Subdivision 2. So if we're going to expend this money, I'm going to ask that the commissioner prioritize those providers that serve the most at-risk kids so we get them first. So Ms. White's going to help me with language.
We've got the language to be considered.
Mr. Chair and members, on page 4, line 1, after the period, insert, the commissioner shall prioritize grants to providers serving the highest risk families as referenced in subdivision 2, period.
Senator Cohen.
I think it's okay. Can I ask Ms. White to repeat the language?
Ms. White.
Mr. Chair and members, the commissioner shall...
On line 4.1.
4.1, after the period, insert, the commissioner shall prioritize grants to providers serving the highest risk families as referenced in subdivision 2.
I think it'd be fine.
It's a friendly amendment. Any further discussion on Senator Benson's oral amendment? Seeing this, Senator Klassen.
Thank you. Just a clarifying question. Would this be if a family, if a provider has four families, would they have priority over a provider that has one family?
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, I can't specifically answer that. I guess we've given the commissioner a lot of discretion as to who these grants go to, and I would like the voice of this committee to be that the commissioner should prioritize those families who serve the most at-risk children. We're trying to get to the largest pool of at-risk kids we can with the amount of money that we're appropriating. And if I spent more time, I could probably be very specific and, you know, grid out how to prioritize things. But I don't think that we have time to do that one, and it's probably not appropriate to insert that kind of specificity into a bill where we've given the commissioner a lot of discretion. And so I would just like this committee to send the signal that we're going to prioritize the youngest and highest risk youngest children and highest risk families.
And I think the evidence bears out that our return on investment is the greatest when we do that. Target carefully. So any further discussion on Senator Benson's oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Cohen, any further testimony?
Mr. Chairman, I have no further testimony.
Anyone in the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 2692? Seeing none, any further questions of members? Senator Rosen?
Yes, Mr. Chair, just looking at the long-term fiscal considerations, it's estimated that the impact of the is beyond the current forecast cycle. I was just wondering if anybody had an idea of after these scholarships are used up, it's estimated there's another 60,000 scholarships that can be awarded. What's the price tag on that? And rules of engagement will be changed, or you know what? I just see it for 2015. What ongoing? What do we have here?
Well. In my fairly quick, we have a preliminary fiscal note in front of us. Senator Cohen, have you had a chance to study this much? In my quick perusal of it, it looks like it's just the cost of the grants and right. the scholarships that are reflected in the fiscal note. Are you asking, should there be some return on investment put into here?
That's not a bad idea, Mr. Chair.
Also, I always suggest that, and rarely see it on the fiscal notes. But
exactly. But it just looks like we are just focused on one budget cycle here, and just wondering what the plan is going forward
okay.
with this program. Well,
okay.
And return on investment.
Senator Cohen.
We'll
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, and members, just a couple things. First of all, the language sets up a reporting process back to us and to the commissioner, so we get the metrics in terms of what this is doing or not doing. So that's in the totality of the legislation. Second, there's no question that this is something that we're embarking on, what the legislature did last year on certainly a bipartisan basis relative to early education is something that in a comprehensive way whether through this methodology or the others we've talked about, is something that's relatively new. I would hope in future legislatures, future bienniums, that if we find this is something that really works, if the metrics establish that we have really made a difference and that the kids who are participating, the kids and families participating, can show that there's been a real significant result, that we'd look at this as being very cost-effective. That I don't mean to speak in cliches, but that at the back end, you'd have less kids than in the juvenile system. You'd have less young adults in the jail and prison system. But Senator Rosen, unless we start at some point, we're not going to know that. Obviously, if a future legislature, not this year's legislative session, makes a decision that this has really worked out very well, yes, the cost would be significantly greater. The legislation in front of you today, though, is on a pilot basis.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rose.
And thank you, Senator Cohen. And Subdivision 2, 3.19, the commissioner shall provide a formative evaluation. What does formative evaluation mean, then, of this pilot project? You mentioned a few things, and especially since we are expanding the home visiting portion in this bill. What does formative evaluation mean?
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rosen, exactly what it says, that we ask the commissioner to study what's happened with the pilot project. So whatever, again, metrics are available. Do we have any type of definitive health changes, education changes, developmental changes? Do we see families maybe getting out of poverty? A little bit tough to specify at the front end what kind of metrics we're going to come up with. We certainly give discretion to the commissioner to try to determine that. Formative is, you know, I'm not sure what the origin of the adjective is, but I think it's a little bit tough at the front end to specify what we're asking, what we expect to look at, unless we give the start. I'm not sure. It looks like Senator Sharon might be able to.
Yes, I'd ask.
Senator Benson had a follow-up.
To the point of substantive versus formative.
Yes.
Formative is a high level, sort of level sense of the program. Substantive is these are the specific metrics that we measured and are being held accountable for and reporting on. Mm-hmm. And so this gives the commissioner discretion to say it appears that, as opposed to saying we put these four kids through this program and here's the difference because they went through. Substantive is much more detailed and metric oriented. And the question came forward in committee and policy committee.
Yep.
With only 1 year, it is very hard to get statistically significant information.
However, Senator Mr. Chair, I do believe that with this amount of money and the wish that this program is successful and that we come forward with the ability to look at this program and say, yes, we need to put some more money into this or we need to make adjustments, I wouldn't be opposed to having a few more, a little more direction to the Commissioner of Health as far as what needs to be looked at. And I wish that was in the language, actually. Formative evaluation. I mean, you could come back and just say, it was a success. We served this many kids. And what does that give us? We don't know if the home pilot project worked, basically. So this is, I know it's a pilot project, but I don't think it's wrong to put a little more beef, I mean, I think you could have a combination, substantive and formative, and just say, all right, we need to have these measurements in place.
Senator Sharon, did you have something
to add? No, Senator Benson, you know, I thought the original question was about how do you differentiate between these kinds of evaluations.
We had a discussion of that in the policy.
Yes. And I would just emphasize that, you know, a year is not a time to give us, you know, substantive information. So I'm trying to think what you could be more specific about in a year's time to be responsive to Senator Rosen's question, and I'm not coming up with anything right now.
Senator Cohen, any?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if Senator Rosen would like to propose some language to broaden that that adjective, I don't know that I would object to that. I don't, Mr. Chairman, if you'd want to lay the bill over and allow Senator Rosen to prepare some language. I don't know that we can. I don't know that you could maybe figure that out in a couple of minutes. I don't know if you would like to do that. I can come back to the committee when my committee's done.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen,
and I know you're on a time frame, but I'm not opposed to that. And I was just wondering if the Department of Health had any ideas of where they were going to be taking this evaluation.
Someone here from the Department of Health who can speak to this? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Maggie Diebel. I'm the director of the Community and Family Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. One of the things that we would like to have considered is extending out the time that we could collect information. There are a couple of programs that are going on now that are collecting information in regard to outcomes for kids. Both Hennepin County and Ramsey have been involved in these family home visiting programs that bring together social services and public health, teen parents particularly, and MFIP, and they are collecting data over a much longer period of time related to decreasing incidents of child neglect and abuse, all of the things I think that were articulated earlier by Patricia Coldwell. Another example is these programs not only result in better outcomes for kids, but also for teen moms. So they have data that's quite interesting related to graduation rates for these teen moms that have improved substantially over time. So I think we would suggest that we extend out the date by which we report back to you, but I also think it would be helpful to be more specific about the kinds of information that would be available in that period of time. Is that helpful?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's helpful. Seems like there's a desire to get a bit more specificity in what would come back and a willingness to engage on that from the department. But it might be a little bit more complicated than we can accomplish sitting right here. Senator Kiffmeyer's been waiting a while. Senator Kiffmeyer?
That's okay, Mr. Chairman. It's all been an excellent discussion, but it's on this subject, which I think, the big thing is how do you know it's effective and how do you know it's successful, right? And I think in the first year of a program, the most important thing to do is to establish a baseline. It's very valuable. You got to know where you're coming from to know whether you made progress. And so in a first year, you can develop that baseline. You also can have entry and exit, measurable points, where were they at on the baseline, and the department can choose those effective things. But the most important thing is that you establish a baseline, and it can be specific to the age. You don't have to wait until high school graduation. It can be specific to a 1-year-old, 2-year-old, 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 5-year-old, that there are certain things that we all know scientifically, evidence-based, that if they are at this stage in their development, it's highly predictive of the future. I mean, the materials themselves give us, the handouts themselves give us that information and are a wonderful basis for us to do. But in a first year, the baseline, I just thought that that might be helpful as we're having the discussion and maybe trying to do some legislation or an amendment around that.
Mr. Chair and members, just to clarify, I was referring to high school graduation rates of the teen moms themselves, not tracking the infants and toddlers and children that are enrolled in the programs. I completely agree. A period of time to get some real substantive outcomes of a year is very difficult, and I think one of the values of doing these kinds of pilot programs is really to get a handle on what it is that we're looking for. We know that nationally, these evidence-based models have really resulted in some tremendous improvements for these children who are reaching developmental milestones. So I think perhaps what you're referring to is, can we track whether or not these kids are achieving what they should be achieving by the time they're a year, 18 months old, or 2 years old? And we want to see them on that great developmental trajectory, as was referred to earlier, where where if we have in place these supports for kids very, very early on, then we're not seeing the kinds of adverse outcomes that are linked to earlier what was referred to the adverse childhood experiences that result in poor outcomes for kids and even adults later in life.
Senator Cohen?
Well, Mr. Chairman, this discussion began with Senator Rosen's concern, I believe where Senator Rosen was leading would be fine, and I think the testimony would suggest that. I'm not sure exactly what kind of language Senator Rosen would like to place in the bill, but I would have no objection to fleshing out what formative means and at least providing some minimal guide to the agencies in terms of what we're looking for. I don't know if Senator Rosen would like to work with the people from the agencies, our counsel, relative to that, so that we have an amendment that would make some sense. Mr. Chairman and Senator Rosen, whatever you might like to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rosen.
Senator Cohen, I do believe that this just needs to, we need to drill down just a little bit on this evaluation.
Okay.
Because if we don't give the department, some idea of what they're engaging with, along with the stakeholders. This has to be part with the stakeholders, because I do believe that there is wonderful research and evidence-based research that you have in the A2 amendment that deals with a baseline. But I'm hoping that what the department comes back to us shows that this program has been effective, or that we need to tweak it in some way to make sure that we're getting,
So we're going to lay Senate File 2692 on the table.
Okay.
Allow for a little bit of time to work on some of these amendments and bring it back up in a little bit, unless something's ready. I mean, it's not ready right now. We need some time to work on it. Senator Cohen.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that would be great. And I can finish chairing my committee in the meantime. And then,
do you need a quorum? Should I go check in?
I was told you probably checked in. I haven't checked in.
Okay.
And so I could finish chairing my committee where we've got the K-12 bill, and at least a part of it, and come back and work with Senator Rosen and others in terms of language that would make some sense.
Mr. Senator Chair, Brownson. I had one quick question whenever you're...
Mr. Chair, frankly, I don't think laying the bill on the table to work on more language is the solution to the problem we have. This is a continually reoccurring problem. Every homeless program comes to this committee and says, we're going to save you money long term. Every MFIP grant request comes and says, we're going to save you money long term. What we don't have is a rigorous economic study that we can run these programs through, and that the evidence that you presented here, the Public Institute for Research and Evaluation has been going on in Washington State, and it helps the legislature understand, and they actually economically study these things. It's not just evidence at the front end. It's specific outcomes, and they show the savings long term so that the legislature can rank prioritize the dollars they're spending. And so while it's fine to work on some language to tighten this up and ask for accountability, I think we need to start looking at a systemic evaluation process, because everything sounds good. It's hard to know what's the most effective.
Senator Benson, many of us have been interested in that for a very long time, sort of dynamic scoring, try to track return on investment, try to figure out how, policies that we put in place that seem intuitively to make a great deal of sense and save money. How do we rank the evidence that we have in front of us and actually score it in a way that we can make better decisions? And it is much bigger than Senate File 2692. But Senator Kiffmeyer, real quickly, and then we are going to lay it on the table. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have the benefit of having served on the policy committee, so I don't get in on all of your discussions, Mr. Chair. But the one question in regards to my school district has a at-risk students where they have a program, taxi program, where they bring them in and they do measurable entry and exit, very specific, exactly like a lot of things I see here, but it is done through the school readiness program. Is this funding at all able, or this work at all able, to include programs such as our through our public schools early learning program?
Senator Cohen?
Chairman, I'm going to ask Ms. Caldwell, because she's been working with both both from a school perspective and from this particular program perspective.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer,
Caldwell.
I don't work a lot with the school systems, the school readiness and early childhood programs, but my the intent of the home visiting services that are provided is that they would integrate with other services in the community, which would include that. So I think that that's well within, you know, the realm of possibility. Certainly there are early childhood family education programs that sometimes provide home visiting services as well. So I think that and then the amendment that Mr. Haugie spoke to are intended to kind of coordinate those services.
Okay, with that, Senate File 2692 is laid on the table to work on an amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Back up. Senator Wicklund, Senate File 2775.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And I'm here today to speak about Senate File 2775. It has multiple, it has two parts. We added a section to the bill last week, and so actually first I'm going to talk about Section 3 in the first engrossment. That was the original bill that I came forward with. And it has to do with allocating funds to conduct a health impact assessment. The fiscal note was created, and it, I believe you have that in your packet. It does say bill number S2775-0. That's the fiscal note for Section 3. There's also another fiscal note that says S2775-2A, and that's actually for Sections 1 and 2 of the bill, current
and
bill.
And does not include the original section, correct?
That does not include it, right.
And
yes.
So you'd need to offer an oral amendment on line 3.1 to insert $218,000, is that correct?
That's correct, yes. Thank you.
Senator Franzen moves that on line 3.1, strike out the dot, 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 and insert $218,000 in order to accommodate the costs in the fiscal note we have before us. On that motion, any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Wicklund.
Thank you. So the project in Section 3, it allocates funds to conduct a health impact assessment. The project deliverables are a preliminary legislative report in January of 2015 and then a full report by March of 2015. Project would gather stakeholders together to study the health impacts of school discipline policies and make evidence-based recommendations back to policymakers for use in decision-making. This is a way to look at the effects, both intended and unintended, of policies on the health of a population. The MDH Advancing Health Equity Report delivered in February triggered an interest for me in the use of the health impact assessment as a way to study and then inform members of the legislature and drive better policy decisions. This is somewhat related to what you were talking about at the committee just now about how to get evidence of outcomes and then reincorporate that into policy decisions. I think this is a way to gather information up front and try and build a comprehensive package of decisions or to help us make our decisions better. And there's a lot of work going on across the country and using health impact assessments and integrating those with public policy decision making. So today I have Phyllis Hill is here from Isaiah, and she is going to speak about work she's done in this area with other health impact assessments.
Ms. Hill, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good morning, Chair Lori and members of the committee. My name is Phyllis Hill, and I'm the lead organizer at Isaiah, which is a nonprofit faith-based organization of churches across the state, working to create healthy, whole, and equitable, thriving communities. Isaiah has conducted two health impact assessments, one on transit, the Central Corridor, and the other on school integration funding. I personally led and organized that one for the HIA on school integration. We have found that health impact assessments are valuable tools for both informing evidence-based policy decisions as well as engaging affected communities. A health impact assessment are tools to understand the health impacts of a policy, project, or decision before it is built or implemented. This is an attempt to make healthier and wiser decisions for the well-being of the whole community. Health impact assessments are also vehicles for organizing stakeholders and those directly impacted by an issue into collaboration to find innovative and effective solutions. Indeed, we believe that community knows something about their own health and has an idea about solutions to offer. HIAs are both a research tool and an engagement tool. So in the HIA that I conducted around school integration policy, we had a list of stakeholders that worked with us. That included a retired medical doctor who is also a professor of health. That included a worker from the Department of Human Services, school board members, both former and current, former principals, an equity director, parent, teachers, and also a school nurse. We wrestled with things such as integration and looking at integration more holistically, not just about proximity to who you're around, but looking at the totality of integration as it relates to the social determinants of health. And we also were able to apply a health lens to people's own experiences around integration, some of them positive and some of them negative. So much like the World Health Organization's that has listed education as a key determinant of long-term health, we need to understand how school policy is impacting the health of our children and subsequently us in our future. This HIA will help understand how school policy impacts children's long-term health and make recommendations to improve disciplined policies. As we know, Minnesota has some of the worst racial disparities in education in the country, and that includes school discipline. So this is damaging, like I said, to our children, their future, and our long-term prosperity as a state. An HIA is not the solution, but it is a research and evidence-based tool that can build community momentum and inform future policy to address these disparities.
Thank you, Ms. Hill.
Welcome.
Senator Wicklund.
So just to conclude, I do have, there are representatives here from MDH who can speak about the fiscal note or any other questions you have. I didn't plan on having them testify, but if you have any questions, they'd certainly be willing and able to answer them. I just like to say again about this particular project. It can help us in two different ways. One is to address a current critical issue, which is the school discipline policies and how it's impacting our communities and just overall health disparities related to that. And then the second is also to begin to discuss how we could use this tool, along with examining outcomes and return on investment and bringing those factors in. How could we combine that with some of this upfront work using something like a health impact assessment? So I don't know if you have any questions about this part of it, and otherwise I can move on to the other.
Are there any questions on the health impact assessment? Seeing none. Let's move on to the other sections.
Okay, thank you. And I do have an amendment for
the A2 amendment?
The A2 amendment, yes, if that could be distributed.
While that's being handed out on the amendment.
And the Mr. Chair, I also the fiscal note that you have, it does relate to the amendment.
Senator Wicklund, let me orient members. We have a second fiscal note. That's the one that's S2775-2A covers. And it covers with this, assuming this amendment is adopted, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
And only the language in the amendment. And only the language in the amendment.
Right. So, did you have a testifier to describe it?
Actually, I just have a few things to say about it. Yep. And then
Senator Whitman?
Mr. Chair, committee, this A2 amendment has been worked out with the stakeholders and with the Department of Health. The amendment provides for the development of a plan that will start to address two major goals. One, to report quality measures by race, ethnicity, language, disability, and other social determinants so that we can identify and eliminate health disparities. And second, it is meant to ensure that safety net providers that serve diverse communities and low-income populations are not penalized under evolving measurement efforts for serving those populations. A report would be due next January on the budget timeline and process for implementation of reporting the quality measures, and another report would be due on January 15th of 2016 with the result of the risk adjustment methodology. And Michael Scandrett is here from the Safety Net Coalition, and he and also Deputy Commissioner Jim Koppel is here. If you need further description of the amendment, they can go into it, or if you don't have any questions, you know, that's okay too.
So. Mr. Scandrett, you're available for questions, or did you have okay?
I'm just available for questions, Mr. Chair.
Any questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves the A2 amendment. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, I also believe there's another amendment. That
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would like to offer the A3 amendment. The A3 amendment deals with being uninsured. We know that the ACA has really started to expand coverage, but it doesn't eliminate all the folks that are uninsured. Safety net providers who serve all patients regardless of their ability to pay will not experience the same reduction in numbers of uninsured as the state's general population. In fact, they actually experience an increased market share of uninsured individuals. To address this concern, my amendment does the following. Provide for the development of a coverage program for children who are eligible for EMA and have life-threatening conditions, but this can't be implemented until 2016. As an interim measure, we'd like to provide grants to safety net providers, including hospitals and nonprofit community-based mental health and dental clinics. I'd like to bring up, if I could, David Godfrey from HCMC and Jonathan Watson from the Minnesota Association of Community Health Center to walk you through the amendment.
And then, Senator Hayden, we have some private fiscal notes you requested for this amendment. We're handing them to members.
That's great.
Are you
comfortable
with them being handed out to the public as well?
Absolutely. I think that's fine.
So we'll make those publicly available as well. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Godfrey.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is David Godfrey. I'm here representing the Hennepin County Medical Center. The bill before you as amended would provide desperately needed services to disabled, chronically, and terminally ill children who are not eligible for health care coverage because of their immigration status. Many of these needed services were available prior to 2012 through the Emergency Medical Assistance Program, a federally mandated health care program that is provided to people who do not qualify for medical assistance or Minnesota care. Beginning in 2012, the benefit set in the EMA program was restricted and now only allows for open access to emergency department services, inpatient hospitalization, chemotherapy, and dialysis. The other Medicaid services may be approved if one meets an extremely high standard of need, which is much higher than our current nursing facility level of care criteria. The restricted benefit set has meant that children go without needed services and must typically seek care in hospital settings, creating tremendous disruption in the lives of children and their families. For instance, scores of children at Children's Hospital with life-threatening or terminal illnesses now must be regularly admitted for inpatient stays to receive their medications rather than receiving them in an outpatient setting. The changes that were made to the EMA benefits set in 2012 have moved the program in the exact opposite direction from reforms Minnesota's made in its other public health care programs. This program forces children into inpatient hospitalizations and emergency departments, even if cost-effective services are available in community settings. In short, it does not, as it currently exists, the EMA program does not provide quality health care, nor does it provide value to the taxpayer. The Department of Human Services released a report in January of this year to the legislature that recommended changes to improve the EMA program. In that report, they concluded that all EMA enrollees should receive a benefit set identical to the one proposed in our bill. While we would fully support this recommendation, we recognize the fiscal restraints that this committee is operating under. So this is a scaled-down proposal, which is a first step by providing a comprehensive coverage program to children. Just quickly, this bill would provide an expanded benefit set to children between the ages of 0 and 22 that is similar to the Minnesota Care Program. It would provide access to long-term care services based on the medical assistance nursing facility level of care. Eligibility for these additional services would be identical to the current EMA program in regards to income eligibility and the requirement that the child must have a life-threatening condition. And finally, because this bill uses state general fund dollars to fund these additional services, it calls for the Commissioner of Human Services to seek a waiver to add this benefit set to the Emergency Medical Assistance Program. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Godfrey. Mr. Watson, did you wish to provide testimony as well?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Open for questions.
Members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Jonathan Watson. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. We represent the state's 17 federally qualified health centers in the state. Mr. Godfrey laid out kind of the rationale for the children, the EMA program for that. I'm going to give you a perspective as it relates to the remaining uninsured in the state of Minnesota, and that's really Sections 5 and 6 of the A3 Amendment. As you know, I've testified here before, but our 17 community health centers really, our patient demographics are kind of a top 10 list of what contributes to disparities. 40% are uninsured, 95% below poverty, and 70% of our patients are not white. Nonetheless, I strongly believe our model of care really delivers results in a cost-effective way. But the bill before you, or the amendment rather, does focus on the remaining uninsured in the state. The projections that are out there now is that from our existing 500,000 uninsured in the state, that will be reduced to between 200,000 and 240,000 individuals. Just a snapshot of who that is. They're likely to be younger, from communities of color, very low income, less educated, and more diverse. And they're more likely to use a safety net provider. That's the key piece of that equation. Kind of looking to our colleagues in Massachusetts as they went through their healthcare experiment, what they did find is that safety net providers didn't see that dramatic drop of a 50% reduction in their uninsured. It only went down about 20% for the community health centers there. In conjunction with that, the total patients increased also 12% at the community health centers in Massachusetts as well. So increased market share in the uninsured and additional patients coming to our doors. So what the amendment real briefly does, it really targets fund to other parts of the safety net. This includes safety net hospitals, community health centers, community mental health centers, and safety net dental providers. These are providers that really target and serve the uninsured, both in the past and into the future. So really the bill, the purpose is to really bridge until we get to land to a better place where we may have more resources to really develop a program to address the remaining uninsured. And again, I would like to thank Senator Hayden and the committee for hearing our request here today, and Senator Wicklund for agreeing to amend her bill.
Thank you. I do have an oral amendment that will need to be incorporated into the A3 from council for an effective date on line 1.13. After the A, insert effective January 1 of 2016. And so that will be, Senator Hayden, that be incorporated into your A3 amendment. And then did you have additional oral amendments to fill in the blanks on the appropriations?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
For suggested amounts?
The suggested amounts would be on starting line 2.16, 500,000.
Oops, we're on 5.12, I guess. You'll have to... the first appropriation.
I'll get it.
Sorry.
I don't have it in front of me.
Yeah.
So,
hand me that back, and we'll make it. So on line 5.12, strike the dots and put in 500,000. On line 5.15, strike the dots and put in 1,750,000. On line 5.18, strike the dot, 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 and put in 6 million. And on line 5.21, strike the dot, 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 and put in 1,750,000. So again, on A, B, C, and D, the four grants, it would be 500,000, 1,750,000, 6 million, and 1,750,000. On those four blank appropriations. And Senator Hayden incorporates that into the A3 amendment. Any discussion from members? Seeing none. On the A3 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. On the bill, any further testimony, Senator Wicklund?
No, I'd just like to say that the amendment to the bill, I take that as a friendly amendment, and it seems like
good,
it's related to this.
Yes.
I know, I'm sorry, I didn't get my words in ahead, but I just wanted to say that.
All right. Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to go back about the health impact study on school discipline policies. I just have a question about the scope of the study. It's going to be looking at the impact of, I assume, exclusion, suspension, expulsion, and the impact on health outcomes. But I'm wondering if it's at all going to look at the causes that led to the action by the school. In other words, it's a cause of effect issue. Are we really going to get at the root of why is that action being taken by the school versus looking at the outcomes of the action of the school? If that makes sense.
Ms. Hill? Response?
Chairman and Senator Claussen. Yes, I think that the health impact assessment can reach to that level. Okay. It's a matter of what we would call the scoping phase, which you will begin to ask what are the questions that we want to actually answer. So if that's one of them that we want to answer, then so be it, essentially.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you. I'd really encourage you to put that. I think that would be really helpful for schools to identify, you know, the cause of the action and try to remedy that so that we can eliminate the expulsion, suspensions, and some of those actions. So I'd really appreciate you take strong consideration of that in your study.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone in the audience wish to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 2775? Seeing none, any further questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves Senate File 2775 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS articles of the finance omnibus. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Chair Lurie, and the committee members.
Senator Hoffman, are you here? Are you ready with Senate File 2521? I haven't seen a fiscal note for this yet. Do you have?
Mr. Chair and members, there should be no fiscal note on these at all.
We will need to have the department come up and confirm that.
Mr. Chair, we'll get the department to come up and confirm both. There's two departments.
Do you have amendments in order to make it fiscally neutral?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to have the A2 amendment be presented in front of you. And
okay, I don't have that in our packet, but we'll have that, the A2 amendment handed. Katie, do you have the A2 amendment? All right. Get that handed out. Mr. Schoenbaum, while that's being handed out, can you describe the A2 amendment and confirm that this would...
Mr. Chairman, Mark Schulman from the Hill Department. Just to the previous question about cost on the bill, it looks like Section 1 of this bill falls in the Health Department. There's no cost to that section.
Okay. And actually, I think the question was regarding DHS. Oh, here's Mr. Holtman. There we go. That's
thank you, Mr. Chair. We don't see a fiscal note issue with publishing this stuff on our website, the public notice requirements there. There is some consideration, I guess, just for members that enacting legislation with a July 1 effective date and adding another 30-day notification period for state plan amendments may cause the department some issues, just in terms of enacting the will of the legislature.
Well, let's hear about the amendment, and then I'd be glad to hear the concerns of the department as we move forward. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The A2 amendment changes the original proposal related to transparency on the state plan amendments. The current language calls for the SPA to be printed in the state register. Given the cost of that, it makes more sense to simply require publication on the Department of Health Services website, along with notification through DHS's electronic communication capacity. This provides for SPAs to be published at no additional cost. Mr. Watson is here to go in more depth if you'd like.
Any questions of members? I mean, I think it's pretty straightforward. Publish an SPA before it's so. I mean, and I think it would be
cost savings,
an improvement on Section 2 according to the department's analysis. So maybe if there's any additional questions on the A2 amendment, maybe we'd be ready to move that one. Senator Sharon moves the A2 amendment. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. So now we have the bill in shape with no cost from the department on that section. Section 3, though, does Section 3 have a cost, Mr. Holtman? Section 4 obviously does, but that one's pretty straightforward. It's an appropriation. See, this is why we really do like to get fiscal notes.
Should be no cost on that. To recoup in dollars.
Section
dual eligible.
Mr. Chair,
Section 3 is the one that basically makes a modification to the classification of rural for. No.
Section 1. Let me go through the bill. Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Would you like me to go through the bill because it can clarify? Section 1 is the rural one. That Section 3 is about the dual eligibles. And there should be no fiscal impact on that either.
The Department of Health confirmed that Section 1 would not have a cost. Section 2, we just addressed the cost in the amendment. Section 3, go ahead and describe it further.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, Section 3, really, the change enacted by the Minnesota legislature in 2011 has been erroneously applied to the federally qualified health centers. Specifically, the state is recouping dollars from those federally qualified health centers for the Medicare, Medicaid dual eligibles they serve. And so this section of the bill clarifies in statute where the Federal Department of Health and Human Services has instructed our Department of Human Services to do, namely provide health centers with their proper Medicaid reimbursement.
Is there a cost to that provision, Mr. Holtman?
Mr. Chair, yes, there is.
Senator Hoffman, do you have a fiscal note for that?
Mr. Chair and members, I was not aware that there was going to be a cost associated. I thought that was, again, going on the neutrally balanced. And that's the information that we've had. So that's brand new news to me.
Well, so, Senator Hoffman, you have two choices ahead, in front of you here. You can either delete Section 3 that we don't know the cost of. I mean, we don't know, correct? We haven't seen a fiscal note. You can either delete Section 3, then we'll understand the fiscal, or you can lay it on the table and roll the dice. I don't know if we'll get back to you or not.
Mr. Chair and members, it is new news to me. Go ahead and delete Section 3. Somebody will have to take an oral amendment, and we'll have to go deal with the federal Medicaid, Medicare folks in a separate action.
Senator Rosen moves an oral amendment to delete Section 3 from the bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Okay, so now we have the bill in shape. We have the department's concerns regarding the publication of the state plan amendments on the website 30 days before filing them. Mr. Holtman, could you elaborate on the department's concerns?
Mr. Chair, it's just something to be mindful of. I think we've already got considerable public notice requirements around waivers, so that's certainly not an issue. But in terms of state plan amendments, I think it's just something to be mindful of. If we add an additional 30-day public notice period, that it may be difficult for us to achieve July 1 effective dates.
You mean because the legislature adjourns in May and may give you direction to seek state plan amendments, so into the future? Is that sort of what you're saying? The timelines might be tight? Is there some technical assistance you could offer to align the timelines to give you, or I guess it would be when we give you instruction to file state plan amendments that we are cognizant of the effective dates and make sure that they allow for that 30-day period? Is that so? It would be watching future bills that come forward where we instruct you to seek state plan amendments.
Mr. Chair, I think for the most part we'll probably be okay. It's just adding another piece of administration to our to getting things done.
Okay. Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chair, Jonathan Watson with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. I really don't have a concern of when we do this. Let's just do this as soon as possible because we Community Health Centers had kind of a bad experience last year relative to a state plan amendment. And so we just want to prevent this in the future, whether that's July, August, September, January. I really don't have a concern on that. Let's just do it so the department can actually publish this stuff and let the public input into this process. So that's my request.
Thank you.
All right. Any further questions of members? Seeing none, I think we've made all the amendments. We've brought the bill so that we understand the fiscal implications are only in regards to the final section, $2 million appropriation to the community health centers, and the rest has no cost. Any further questions of members? Anyone in the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 2521? Seeing none. Senator Rosen moves Senate File 2521 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS article for the finance omnibus. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Hoffman, we got another one here. I haven't seen a fiscal note yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This one is not, I can guarantee you, there's a balance of neutrality here.
I have a hard time putting your guarantees on a spreadsheet.
Mr. Lauren Coleman can come up and chat with us as well on this if you'd like. But this is a promise, Mr. Chair and members. Last year, rate modification, right? We sat down, we had this almost a $2 billion program that is there
now,
for
Mr. Coleman's promises. I have an easier time putting it on the spreadsheet. Do you have an amendment to offer, Senator Hoffman, in order to provide clarification to make this neutral?
There is some oral amendments there. Senator Egan is not here.
Well, does staff have an amendment? We're not. Everybody's shaking their heads. We don't know.
I can tell you what they are if you'd like. I apologize. Next time I'll get my act together before I come in front of you. Delete sections 12, 13, and 14. And 12, that changes to the budget neutrality protections. Those were concerns raised by MMB. Number 13, it provides provider appeals. There is a large fiscal cost of provider appeals, so we delete that out. And then number 14, the individual appeals, there's a fiscal cost to that. We deleted that out. Having those three deletions, Mr. Chair, brings this budget neutral and no fiscal cost.
Mr. Coleman, is that the case?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've spent a number of hours with the coalition to understand the bill, and certainly those amendments were part of the what was producing a substantial fiscal cost. We would need to still seek some clarification about the remaining parts of the bill. But I would say that we have a mutual goal to try and get the bill in shape so that there would be no fiscal cost to the state. But I can't commit to, at this point, that it has no fiscal cost. We'd have to reexamine some assumptions.
When might you be able to have that reexamination completed?
We're ready to meet and see clarification on some remaining elements of the bill as soon as the parties can find some time.
Let's find some time right now. Senate File 2679 is laid on the table. We're not going to be hearing bills without fiscal notes.
Mr. Chair.
And we'll take up those amendments when you come back. Senator Rosen.
I'd just like to say with all due respect, Mr. Coleman, if there is a fiscal cost to it, then the department should eat it.
What's that?
The department should eat it.
Well, so we'll try to get it back up before us, before we're done. But we really do, in order to do our work, we have to have a fiscal note in order to evaluate a proposal. And so, I mean, I think we're close. We're going to do the work. And I think they heard you on there. Way out to work on this.
Senator Lord, do you know why we're not having physical notes?
Senator Sharon, what?
I mean, this is not a new discussion. This bill has been around lots of hearings. Is there a reason why we don't have physical notes? Maybe you don't know the answer to that.
I don't know the answer to that.
I think it's stunning to me that we're sitting
Rosen?
Here.
Well, and in defense of the department, I do know it is because of Mincher. They are working very, very hard to get Mincher up and going. So there is a lot of department energy towards Mincher.
Well, this is the Continuing Care Administration. It's a different wing. I mean, I don't think there's a big overlap there. I think they should be able to work through this.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Albrecht,
and Senator Sharon, to answer your question, in my discussions with the department about the fiscal note for this bill, there have been until yesterday, actually apparently until this morning, ongoing discussions with the advocates of this bill, and so completing a fiscal note on language that was sort of evolving was just too much of a challenge at the time and with the timelines that we had.
So, Senator Rosen, do you have some amendments ready for Senator Cohen's bill? He's on his way back over here. Have you worked some of that out? We could pick that one back up.
Mr. Chair, there was some language that was worked out, and Ms. Kavanaugh has it.
My understanding is that Senator Cohen is on his way back.
Mr. Chair, I also asked Senator Franzen, if she is a co-author, if she could also do it, too, and she agreed to that. So,
Senator Franzen?
But I haven't seen the amendment yet, as far as...
Okay. He's on his way right now. I mean, we... But Katie Cav, Ms. Kavanaugh has the...
Has the language. Because we could actually just do it orally, too.
We don't have Senator Eakin. We don't have Senator Eaton. We don't have Senator Hayden. We're going to recess at the call of the chair. Don't go far. It's not going to be a long one, but... Just committee back to order. We have some proposed amendments for Senator Cohen's...
Okay. Oh, no, no. I just wanted you to...
Senate File 2692. Senator Cohen, welcome back.
I appreciate you talking to me. The thing I've complained about is people not talking to me. Maybe I'm
And if I was there, I would have had that discussion.
I guess the mics weren't on. I'll go again. We call the Health and Human Services Division back to order. I believe that we've got some amendments to consider to improve Senator Cohen's 2692 that was laid on the table a little bit ago. Senator Cohen, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I just had presented to me by Ms. Kavanaugh the A4 amendment, and I had a chance to talk briefly to Senator Rosen relative to her drafting of this. So it's certainly perfectly acceptable. I think provides more direction to the agency in terms of what we'd like to look for relative to outcomes. So obviously I'm not on the division, cannot offer the amendment.
So Senator Rosen?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A4 amendment.
Move to the A4 amendment. On that amendment, any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Yep. And this is, this is a start. I think the department can maneuver and continue on with this. But my thought is, if you don't have a little bit more goals in your evaluation, we will be asking for them later on. So you should be at least be thinking about what you want this formative evaluation to be. Going forward, and as I said before, I want this program to be successful. So, give us the identify the populations being served, including geographic area, the risk factors, and the demographics. Strategies being used to coordinate health, social services, and other community resources. Which number two is a little bit vague, a little bit nebulous, but I still think it will at least start the conversation for the three departments to move forward.
Any further discussion on the A4 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. On the bill, any further questions of members? Anyone in the audience wish to offer additional testimony in support or opposition to Senate File 2694? Oh.
Mr.
2692. I'm sorry, the amendment has. I was reading.
Okay.
So, seeing 2692, any further testimony from anyone in the audience? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I would move. I move that 2694.
Two.
Or 92, excuse me. As amended, be recommended to pass and laid over its possible inclusion in the article, HHS article. I should have wrote this down.
For the
of the HHS omnibus bill.
Of the finance omnibus bill.
Finance bill.
And actually, yesterday I got a little bit of friction from staff. We have to say articles because we have so much here. There's going to be several HHS articles. I had to turn it plural for Ms. White. Sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bouncen. On Senator Rosen's motion, any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Senator Eaton, you have two bills. Do you have a preference for which you would like to take up first?
I do not.
Senate File 1864, Mental Health Crisis Intervention and Stabilization Services. Senator Eaton.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is, it's about identifying and treating mental illness early. That is more effective in terms of cost, but more importantly, in terms of the individual. We have mobile crisis teams around the state, though not in every county. We want to clarify that these teams can go out and work to engage people voluntarily in treatment. They don't have to wait until there's a full-blown emergency and the person meets the criteria for commitment or hospitalization. I have with me Sue Aberholden from NAMI. And Cindy Dillette.
Welcome to the committee. Who wishes to? Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. I am sure that each of you as a legislator has received a call from a constituent whose loved one was experiencing serious symptoms of a mental illness. They were desperate. They saw their loved one decompensating, but there was nothing they could do. They didn't yet meet hospital level of care or the criteria in the Commitment Act, and they weren't willing to access treatment. So imagine how painful it must be to watch someone you love become sicker each passing day or hour, and you're totally helpless. NAMI receives these calls every week, nearly every day. This bill would actually change this scenario. Currently, the law governing crisis teams differentiates between an emergency and a crisis, but for all intents and purposes, they really don't. Imagine calling 911 because your loved one is having chest pains. Would they say, call us back when you're sure your loved one is having a full-blown heart attack? Of course not, but that is what, in essence, our crisis teams are doing. Under this bill, we are promoting identifying and treating mental illnesses early. A good mental health professional or practitioner can go out multiple times to develop a level of trust and engage the person in obtaining voluntary treatment. They will work with the family, educating and supporting them during this difficult time. The teams will engage peer specialists, people who live with a mental illness, who are in recovery and have specialized training, who can also try to convince the person to accept treatment. The teams will be required to really listen to the families, and we are often the canary in the coal mine, and know when those symptoms are beginning to return. The bill also underscores the importance of an advanced psychiatric directive, and teams will be encouraged to work with the person to develop one. In addition, ensuring what I like to call a warm handoff is important. Giving someone a piece of paper with a number to call when the symptoms of their mental illness is interfering with their ability to concentrate and follow through on tasks doesn't make much sense. We need to make sure that they become connected to the right people and providers. This is not to criticize our crisis teams at all, but this is a fairly new service in Minnesota, and now that we have several years of experience, it's time to make changes and strengthen them. We don't yet, the fiscal cost is not huge, but I also want to remind people that the crisis teams over the years have actually prevented hospitalizations, and so intervening early will save even more money. We really want to make sure that families aren't placed in the impossible situation of watching a loved one decompensate to the point that they meet the Commitment Act criteria. We want to promote early and voluntary treatment. And Cindy Nolet is here, who is a mom, to share her story.
Hi, thank you.
Ms. Nolet, welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
My name is Cindy Dolette, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee. I'm grateful for this opportunity to share our story. Our story, sadly, is not an anomaly, and as I've become more and more involved with NAMI, I hear a version of our story all the time, and I just like to share parts of our story. I'm here to share some information as to how this bill could be beneficial and critical on many levels. The services that this bill could provide could have potentially altered the course of what my son and what our family has gone through. I'd like to share some parts of our story, my son's story, again because it is relatively common in the world of mental health. The bill could alter lives in a very positive way, with clear and identifiable changes to the lives of those impacted by a severe mental illness. It could put much less stress on our family systems and have tremendous, tremendous economic savings in the long term. It is likely that for some, certainly not all, but for some, the long-term trajectory could be changed if we could provide services early and in the most meaningful of ways. It is possible that we could reduce the progression of the severity of the mental health symptoms by providing critical care at the earliest of stages. I am Jacob's mom. Jacob, is a wonderful, bright 29-year-old man with a severe mental illness. About 4 years ago, Jacob was a senior in college at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. Professors there identified Jacob as one of the strongest and brightest students that they had seen. They saw him as extremely promising in the art world. He began to show significant changes in his mood and personality. He was severely irritable, had erratic and somewhat concerning mood and behavior changes, and reacted to things that simply did not exist for most of us. He had odd perceptions. He would say and do things that most anyone would interpret as strange and odd. Friends and family members were alarmed. I contacted many people on the front end and was told that Jacob was an artist, was quirky, he was an adult, and I was probably an enabling mom and should merely back off. Jacob spent all of his money, went into significant debt, and lost his promising job. He was expelled from school. One night, he went to my brother's cabin, his uncle's cabin in northern Minnesota, and he had no permission to be there. He wanted to look at the lake and walk around on the beautiful property. We were all alarmed because he had no permission to be there, and we were so concerned about his behavior that we contacted the local sheriff's department. Jacob was walking peacefully around the property, and from what he can recall, he described that a SWAT team came from the woods, jumped on him, and according to him, took him down. Obviously, the intervention was traumatic. Jacob was hospitalized in Park Rapids, Minnesota, was later transferred to Brainerd because there were no mental health facilities, and there were no hospital beds available in Minneapolis. He spent a month in the Brainerd Hospital before a sheriff's transport was available to bring him back to Hennepin County. Over the course of that time, Jacob became more and more psychotic. I desperately was asking for help for Jacob and for myself over that period of time. It was at that point when he returned to the cities, because so much time had elapsed, the symptoms had worsened, that Jacob received his first stay of commitment. The lack of immediate, early intervention care services for Jacob and our family created an unimaginable amount of trauma, and it was our first $500,000 bill. Jacob did not stabilize. Jacob was non-compliant with medication and was semi-compliant with other services. Part of his mental health condition is the inability to see and understand that something is terribly wrong. It's very different than denial. Thus, he was committed several more times. He continued to resist treatment despite our best efforts. I strongly advocated to get him the care and the help that he needed. It was a long, hard road with obstacles seemingly around every corner. My son has been in the hospital for months on end over the last 4 years. In fact, during his last hospital admission, we were identified as their frequent flyers. I tried to access help again many, many times. Help was either not available, was not accessible, or our request was denied. As a result, my son, my beautiful son, and my family suffered immeasurable losses. The financial losses are profound to my son, to me, to our healthcare system, and to our community. I'm well educated, I'm a strong advocate, and I'm a psychologist in the community. I know the community, I know the mental health system, I knew many of the physicians. I reached out time and time again. I advocated passionately and to the best of my ability. I spoke and I begged for what I believed would have been the most immediate, least intrusive for Jacob and for myself, and certainly the most cost-effective intervention for my son when he was so very ill and unable to advocate for himself. I begged for help on the front end as he was destabilizing and in the very early stages of his illness. I knew as a mom and as a mental health professional that this was the time to get help, that this was the time to make a difference. I was realistic to know that if a mental illness was evolving, the services may not have altered the trajectory of Jacob's diagnostic presentation, but I knew that it would alter the trajectory of the suffering of our family. Jacob did not see the need for help, so did not seek it. He resisted the help when opportunities were available, such as through crisis services. He did not get help when he so desperately needed it, and given the nature of his condition, things got worse, much worse. Interventions ultimately were forced. He was traumatized. We were traumatized. The financial costs were unbearable. I am not sure I will ever be able to recover from the financial strains that were placed on me. Over the last 4 years, Jacob has been hospitalized at least 6 times. Honestly, I've lost count. Most often for weeks to months at a time. The accumulative costs, I did a quick tally of the bills, of the hospital bills alone. This did not include emergency visits nor other outpatient costs, but the accumulative cost of hospital admissions has been well over $3 million over the last 4 years. I have spent many tens of thousands of dollars of other costs, medical, financial, legal, housing, school debt, $80,000 of school debt that Jacob's not able to pay. At one point, Jacob said, "I've lost my life." As a mom, I knew some things were terribly wrong. I reached out repeatedly. I took him into the emergency room, only to have him identified as quirky and artistic and then released. I called crisis intervention many, many times. In fact, I knew their number by heart. I called the police. I made visits, multiple visits, to our local precinct. Again, Jacob denied that he needed help and denied any opportunity to get help. At times, crisis staff would come out. Sometimes they wouldn't come out, sometimes they would come out. When they would come out, they most often left our home when Jacob denied that he needed help. But yet, he was not felt to be in imminent danger. I was repeatedly asked, is he suicidal or homicidal? And the answer was no. We now know that the inability to see and understand his illness is, in fact, part of the condition that he struggles with. While I worked with many, many good people, I did not find the help that was needed and that I knew he needed. I knew that Jacob needed intense help again and could not seek it. I wanted to avoid disaster. I was concerned that Jacob's life was at stake and that others could be impacted. Fortunately, my son has never been violent, but he has driven his car when he's had altered perceptions. He's driven his car when he's had poor attention due to his internal preoccupations, and he's had sensory distortions. Not only have I been concerned for Jacob, but as I've said to the police many times, I've been concerned for the public safety. Jacob's walked downtown. He's taken the bus. He's been mugged. He's been victimized. He went outside and walked for miles on end without a coat when it was 20 below. I've been told by crisis and the police that they cannot do anything if Jacob does not want help, if a law is not broken, or if there is no imminent danger to self or others. Anyone, and I want to emphasize anyone, in a psychotic state such as what Jacob has been in is 1 second away from imminent danger. I often ask people to come into our home. I asked at the hospital, I asked mental health providers, I asked the crisis intervention staff. I asked if they could come into the home on several occasions to see if by coming into the home they could establish trust with Jacob and they could actually see Jacob, because there were times that Jacob could look sort of okay for a few minutes. He could regroup during some of the emergency room visits. I was hopeful that Jacob would be able to build a rapport, and if a rapport was built, the trust could be established. I was hopeful that Jacob could begin to obtain some of the treatment that he so desperately needed. I could not get what I thought he needed. I was told so many times, I cannot count. Again, if he's suicidal, homicidal, or if he's in danger, call 911. Despite not meeting that criteria in a direct and obvious way, I called 911 many times. I called crisis intervention to the point during several episodes that they knew my name. I called the police on a number of occasions as a last resort because I was so desperate and I knew that something needed to stop and that Jacob needed to be admitted in order to stop the cycle. Despite my providing background information to the police, Jacob was severely roughed up on one occasion and badly bruised. Jacob panicked. He was of no immediate danger to others, but what became just asked somebody to back off. And the police officer became aggressive with him. Other times we had very kind officers, but Jacob was hauled off in cuffs. Several times Jacob was needed to do what I've identified as the perp walk down our residential block in Linden Hills. I later learned that to have the police come out in the middle of the night to prevent our neighbors from seeing what was occurring in our block due to the stigma surrounding mental health and the fact that it's not just our block, it's not our house, it's my home. It's the home that I've lived in for 30 years. Hospitalizations are often necessary, but as most of us know, are not treatment-oriented. The goal is stability. There has been severe trauma from psychosis that goes untreated. There is severe trauma from the process of getting admitted to the hospital, especially with police interventions. The hospital is a scary environment. Jacob has always regressed further in the hospital due to the trauma of admission, yet he is needed to be there. Dial ahead to now. Jacob lives at home. Jacob is still under commitment and is under Jarvis and is taking his medication willingly. Jacob finally has the services of an ACT team. I call them our angels. I've asked for the ACT team for years, and believe me, many mental health professionals I've worked with haven't even known what the ACT team is. Jacob is thriving. Jacob is stable. He's pleasant. He's regaining his cognitive skills. He's regaining his life skills. He's developing a nice understanding of what his condition really is. He's trying to rebuild a life damaged. He has a job as a freelance web designer. He has a phenomenal work ethic and wants to get off Social Security. He is taking it one day at a time, as I am. But he's hopeful, and so am I, and motivated that he'll be 100% self-sufficient and have stable mental health. That's his goal. Last night, before bed, he said, "For the first time in 6 months, I feel like I'm finally living." Our history is our history. I stand by my original and ongoing request to have you consider early intervention services to interrupt the cycle of disturbance and severe disruption in the lives of our loved ones. It can be life-saving. It will be cost-saving. It will be life-giving. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Eakin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to state that in my other life, I work on ACT teams as a nurse. And I've seen these crisis teams, and we've worked with them very closely. This bill gives them more tools to use to not have to wait till somebody's in a suicidal or homicidal state. So I strongly support this bill. I do believe that the requirements that are part of the bill to train teams and advance directives can really be done with a video that someone can watch. I really challenge the funding request for FTE. I don't think it's necessary. The providers can figure out how to do the training, and probably through computer-based. So,
Senator Eaton, I was actually looking at that FTE also. In the fiscal note, it says that it's to support implementation of new mobile crisis services proposed in this bill. I believe that's in regards to Section 5. The only two new services are linking clients to referred services and providing follow-up and working with the recipient to develop advanced directives. And I tend to agree with you. I think that an FTE, you know, a permanent FTE, probably more than would be required to accomplish that. I wonder if there's somebody from DHS who could come and speak to.
Did you want to speak to?
Mr. Chairman, if I might too, I just did get an email this morning from Patricia Siebert from the Minnesota Disability Law Center, who works on advanced directives, and she said she would be happy to be videotaped and make that available to the crisis teams.
Is there anyone from DHS who would like to come and speak to the FTE issue? I don't see anyone. Any members have questions? Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question about the advanced directive. So we're going to be helping people in mental crisis develop an advanced directive. Is that different than the advanced directive, say, I worked on with my parents and my husband and I have? Is it different in the mental health community? I don't understand.
It's focused more on their illness and what they would prefer to do if they start showing this symptom. They're indicating to their family or team that they would like this intervention done. Right. And or directing them to ask somebody else to make those decisions on their behalf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none. Senator Franzen moves that Senate File 1864 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS articles for the finance omnibus. Before we vote on that motion, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1864? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members. This is normally not my issue of interest. It's not autism, but as I listen to Senator Eaton and the person from NAMI and the previous mom before me, I think about the minority communities, and I think about the Somali communities and African Americans in particular that have a lot of mental problems. And I just feel like as though that the diversity and making sure that these treatments are culturally responsive, linguistically appropriate, which are actually following the class federal guidelines, I feel as though that's missing the videotape that was just talked about. How we're going to make sure that communities of color.
I'm sorry. Could you state your name for the record?
Oh, sure. Aida Labdol.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
And continue.
Sorry about that. How will Senator Eaton's bill make sure that the treatments are culturally responsive? For example, there are a lot of Somalis in Hennepin County Medical Center that are in the mental illness center. And unlike, you know, I think we're not asking Jack and Jill if an African-American man in his 20s and 30s is having mental illness, the police are more likely going to arrest him and give him a record rather than send him to a mental treatment center. So how will this make sure that those communities who are just as American as apple pie, that they get the culturally responsive treatments and that the training is also culturally and linguistically appropriate. I hope somebody offers something to make sure that gets added. Thank you.
Ms. Abderholden has a response. Ms. Saad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We actually have some very good data, especially in the Twin Cities, the metro area's crisis teams, where we've actually been able to close the gap on disparities when the crisis teams goes out. We have families that are more willing to call the crisis team than actually go into the emergency room. And I know that the training through the Department of Human Services has actually focused a lot on making sure that we have culturally competent staff going out. Now, that doesn't mean we're 100% correct. They do also have access to interpreters during those times, which we think is really important if someone does not speak English. And so it's something that they are working very hard on. It's always, of course, an issue across our healthcare system, but we know that particularly the crisis teams in the metro area have better data than some of our other mental health services in terms of reaching a more diverse community.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm new at this. In Somali, people just talked. I appreciate that. I just really would hope that, again, we include that in the bill and that also in the future when no one looks like me that is talking for mental illness. Mental illness is a huge problem in communities of color. So we need to outreach to them. And Minnesota has one of the worst health disparities. So the fact that people in DHS or anybody else is doing an outreach, it is not doing any good because we are the bottom of the pit for health disparities for communities of color, particularly Black and Latino. And unless the language is specific and it's on the bill, it's a law, many of these hospitals or community centers or trainings are not doing. For example, in the Somali community, I can think of many, many family members and many relatives who came from war-torn countries who have mental illness who have no idea where to start, let alone get the treatment. So it has to be very clear, and we have got to not just say we know disparity exists, but we're going to eradicate disparity by doing 1, 2, 3. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abdul. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1864? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 18. No, we already have a motion. Senator Franzen already moved. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Yeah, aye. Okay.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Senator Eaton. I don't think we'll have time for any other bills. We'll recess. I know that there's a notice that had gone out, you know, that we were going to come back this evening and then at 4. I think we have just a manageable amount of work. I'd like to call back the committee 15 minutes after recess from the floor, and we'll come in and finish our work. We have a fairly manageable piece of it, and we can hopefully get through that efficiently and then move on. Senator Rosen?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So we just have the three bills left plus Senator Hoffman's bill to bring back up?
Plus Senator Hoffman's
okay.
bill. Yep.
Thank you.
Three bills. So we have Senator Carlson's and Eaton's cancer surveillance, Senator Carlson, Senator Eakin, Senator Hayden's, and then coming back to Senator Hoffman. So we have four bills and then finish up Senator Hoffman's.
Okay.
In there. So with that, the committee stands adjourned at the call of the chair. It stands in recess at the call of the chair 15 minutes after session adjourns.
So you never did it.
We're calling the Health and Human Services Division back to order, and we're going to take up Senator Eakin's Nursing Home Moratorium Exception Projects Bill next.
Thank you,
Senator Eakin. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 2349 is a bill to invest in the Nursing Home Facility Moratorium Fund, which we're asking for $1 million in funding.
Senator Eakin, you have an A1 author's amendment?
I do. I have a delete all amendment that I would also like to move. So, and that is to put it in the shape and form that I would like.
Senator Eakin moves the A1 amendment. On that amendment, it's an author's amendment. On that amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And the amendment, what it does is that it basically takes the same language as what was used 2 years ago in the moratorium bill. And it's just a one-time appropriation. It's not ongoing. And it's to replenish the fund, which has been depleted, for nursing homes that are seeking to make improvements on the facilities that they have, maintenance on the facilities that they have. And if this money is not made available, we would see a complete stop in the projects that have been done as a result of this fund being available. And this fund has generated a lot of economic activity and a lot of building activity. It has a positive impact on Minnesota's economy generally. It's estimated that this $1 million investment would result in about $120 million of construction and work and maintaining and improving these facilities. So I guess with that, I do have a couple of people here that could testify and answer questions.
Wish to offer very brief testimony. Is that correct?
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Eakin, members of the committee. My name is Todd Bergstrom, and I work with Care Providers in Minnesota. And my colleague Jeff Bostick works with Aging Services of Minnesota, and together we are here at the Capitol as the Long-Term Care Imperative. Just very briefly to note that this is a very important appropriation. It does allow nursing facilities to engage in large projects to replace and upgrade their infrastructure. A smaller round just concluded. That was carryover funding, and unfortunately with that round, I believe 5 facilities applied and only 4 were in fact awarded their funding. We also believe that more would have applied if there was more money available. So just to stress, this is a very important way for nursing homes to move forward and rebuild their physical plant.
Mr. Bostick, did you also wish to?
Yes, very quickly. Jeff Bostick with Aging Services of Minnesota. I just want to say we view this as a very important priority, a very important appropriation. It's much needed out there to invest in these facilities. And we did an appropriation 2 years ago of $1 million, and we're able to upgrade or even replace 18, I think, is the total number of facilities. So in case you're wondering, for a ballpark in terms of what we might be able to do with this over the next year or two. Thanks.
Thank you. Senator Eakin, the fiscal note that we have, is that drafted to the A1? Does the A1 amendment?
Yes, and Mr. Chair, that would be the A1, I believe.
Or is that not? Mr. Chair and Senator Eakin and members, I am looking at the fiscal note now, and it is drafted to the bill as introduced.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Eakin, the only change would be on the last page, page 7. At the very top there where it says cost / savings change in fiscal year 2017, change the 350 to 300. And then the federal share and the state share down below that would basically be reduced by the proportionate share. So the federal share becomes 150, and then the state and county shares would be adjusted accordingly. So if this were to go in, there would be a little bit different numbers on the spreadsheet for fiscal year 2017.
Any questions of members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, how is this, how does the department do this? Is it a ranking of first come, first serve, or is it
the size of the project, or is it metro versus metro rural?
Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, it's a RFP process where the Department of Health would issue instructions in July. Nursing facilities would apply, and there is a review panel that's appointed, I believe, by the Commissioner of Health as well as state agency representatives, and they hear the proposals and then rank, review, and ultimately the Commissioner of Health, based on their recommendations, makes approval.
Evenly split.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, evenly split between metro and rural?
Mr. Bergstrom?
Or does that not matter?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I would imagine yes. I've never really looked into it, but generally speaking, the most facilities that apply do receive funding. Not always, but in many cases they do.
And just to clarify, maybe the response, it's
Mr.
open
Boston.
To anyone in the state to apply to do one of these projects. So the metro versus rural split depends to a large extent on who is interested in participating in a given year.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 2349, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS articles for the finance omnibus. On that motion, any further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 2349? Seeing none, on Senator Eakin's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Eaton, are you ready with Senate File 2545? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Chair. Senator Eaton.
Senate File 2545 is a cancer surveillance system modification. This system was created in 1987 and is the statewide cancer registry. The system collects data on demographics, diagnosis, and treatment information on all Minnesotans who are diagnosed with cancer. The goal of this program is to monitor the occurrence of cancer, inform health professionals on specific cancer risk, promote cancer research, and guide decision makers on how to target resources. Last year, the department received additional funds to upgrade their cancer reporting system. This bill would require them to collect data on occupation, places of work, time spent in the military, and location of that military service. I have a couple testifiers who will be brief.
Okay.
You want me to go first?
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
I'm Dr. Vincent Gary, and I'm a professor emeritus at the University of Minnesota in laboratory medicine and pathology. I was director of the environmental medicine and pathology group, and I am a toxicologist and board certified and a member of the board of directors of the American Board of Toxicology. We've had the opportunity over the years to do a number of cancer studies, and one of them involved tool and die workers. And in that study, we accessed the individual's medical records. We had to go through and get permission to do each one of these things. And we then identified, with their permission, their medical records and determined the amount of cancer in the workplace among the tool and die workers. We did further biomarker studies, identified the kind of chemicals that could induce that kind of cancer. Now, that took years to do. We have the opportunity right now to get information on occupation and, I'm a colonel, retired U.S. Army Medical Corps. My specialty was chemical defense, and during Desert Storm, I was one of the people required to figure out whether that guy was going to use chemical or not. Anyway, getting back to what we were talking about, both getting information about occupation and getting information about a veteran status seems to be an issue with the health department. I don't understand it, never will. I can tell you that you can, it is possible if you follow a HIPAA rule, you might be able to access the VA system and get information on who's a veteran and how long they did this, that, and the other thing. You can do that if you know how to do it. Similarly, there is also another avenue that you can use, and in my dotage, I do Social Security disability reviews. And in that, I have access to the entire medical record of an individual. I have access to their occupational history going back, way back. And in that occupational history, it is very detailed, telling you what the patient did, how they did it, and for how long. All of that data is there. How you access that data is the question. And that's plan B. Plan A is going the other way, which is probably going to cost a heck of a lot more money. So that's all I have to say.
And Mr. Gary, plan A is what we see in the assumptions from the
right.
Department of Health.
Right.
Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. Mr. Hess, you also wish to offer some testimony?
Welcome I'll be very brief. Thank you, Senator. Good afternoon. I'm Bernie Hess. I'm a member of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 1189. We support Senate File 2545. We feel it's a common-sense approach. It will collect information that could understand cancer clusters throughout Minnesota. We view this as a foundation to build upon to help health professionals and citizens learn about cancers which might be present in their communities. We represent workers in 100 different work sites in the state. Our members' health and safety is a priority for us. Our members work in many different industries, which include meatpacking, manufacturing, and retail, along with health care. The information we can gather would be a good thing. I come out of factory work a long time ago. We've made great strides compared to what workers used to be exposed to and the lack of knowledge back in the early 70s. I'm just hopeful that we can move this bill along because we need more information to make work sites and communities a lot safer in Minnesota. And just a comment, I saw the fiscal note not long ago. I guess I'm surprised, and I would hope that we could have a conversation with the department on how they arrived at this. And I would also like to have more discussions with the department on why there's been some resistance to collecting more information, which we always thought would be a good thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hess.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. I just wanted to mention that Susan Vento was going to speak, but she has a personal family emergency. But she speaks very strongly about the her husband, Bruce Vento, who died of a mesothelioma, and how long it took for them to track that down and figure out what was going on with that group of workers, and how she thinks this kind of information could have led to an earlier detection of that cancer. And that's the other argument I have is I don't see a good argument against doing this. I think the fiscal note is pretty out of line. We gave them quite considerable amount of money to update the system last year. I believe close to $30 million. You would think adding two additional data pieces would not be a big strain on that.
They have a relational database now that they're building, so they'll be able to do that easily.
Mr. Gary?
They have a relational database that they're building, and they ought to be able to attach this on easily.
Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair, is the department available to comment on why the fiscal note is the size that it is?
Mr. Greenman?
Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Health. One of the bills that we sometimes when we come across a bill and we're asked to fiscal note it, we need to make a lot of assumptions about what we need to do in order to implement the bill. And what we currently do when we collect data for our cancer registry is we ask the hospitals and the clinics where the cancer is being reported or the cancer is treated or found to report that information to us. And our review of the bill is that we're going to be asking them to report this information as well, the way we read the bill. I'm happy to go through the assumptions if that would be something the committee wants to hear, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if that's...
Senator Benson, is that what you're wishing? I see the 10 assumptions listed as bullet points here on page 2 of the fiscal note.
Yes, I think Benson. I understand those, Mr. Chair. So I'm getting the impression, and perhaps Mr. Greenman, if he's in a position to answer, this isn't something the department's asking to do for research purposes? Because I know that the health, Mr. Chair, the health department has asked for a lot of data points for research purposes, yet they don't seem very supportive of this. And so I'm wondering if either Mr. Greenman or someone else from the department can help me understand if the department wants this or not.
Mr. Greenman, are you able to?
I think I probably, Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I probably have to, I'm here to talk about the fiscal note, so I'd have to defer to somebody else to talk about that.
Is there, Mr. Koppel, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Benson. It has been our belief for some time that the collection of this data, as Mr. Greenman mentioned, the assumptions are that this is asking us to include this in what is reported to us. What is reported to us comes from the provider through a medical record. Therefore, this would be part of that medical record. So the concerns we have are, number one, this is voluntary information that will be collected at a provider level, passed along, may be general in nature, may be specific, depending on what type of how thorough the job is done, details, et cetera. And the fiscal note is really our effort to go out and make sure that providers are reporting this in a way that is usable. Having said all that, we do special studies now where we look at, when we go in and look at a particular geography or employer, we are going to look at in detail all of those things. For instance, if you worked in a factory, where did you work in that factory? What was your exposure? How long were you exposed each day? How long did you have each job? All of those things become very relevant when you're doing this kind of research, and that would not be part of a general reporting system of occupational history. So the question is the merits of general reporting of occupation, which we feel would not be helpful in the detailed research necessary to draw conclusions about environmental danger or occupational danger, excuse me.
Mr. Koppel, so in the assumptions, would that be making you dive deep enough to get those data elements or not? So you'd have to do all this work and you still wouldn't have the data sufficient, is what I'm hearing you say?
Mr. Chairman, that would be correct.
Any further questions of members? Senator Benson. So,
Mr. Chair, it sounds to me like this data is being collected without a specific purpose. There's no goal. It's just going to sit there, and I don't know what's going to happen with it. So are we wasting a lot of people's time when there's no objective research attached to it? Is somebody going to start looking at this for reasons outside the legislature? I'm really uncomfortable with continuing to collect data and not have some clearly articulated legislative purpose. It might be interesting, but I don't know if it's purposeful.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Eaton.
The purpose of the cancer survey surveillance program is to try and identify early types of cancer that are happening in certain areas or certain age groups or under certain conditions. And this is strongly supported by the Cancer Society, and this is how the Department of Health works with I shouldn't tell you how you work, but they collect data on a lot of things and then determine, you know, whether, like, there's a lot of flu cases here, and then they determine what they need to do about that. Or this is just part of that, only we are asking that it be done for issues related to cancer so that decisions can be made for the citizens of Minnesota related to their health.
Senator Eaton, I think one of the issues that Senator Benson might be raising is that this is changing the existing authority to paragraph A, where it says that the commissioner will collect data and basically look for cancer clusters and incidents. And then paragraph B is the new language, and it's just requesting that this information be collected, and there is no use at all specified in the proposal that's before us. It's not included in the use that's covered in the reporting.
My understanding was it was, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I mean, that's not how I'm reading it as I look at it. Mr. Koppel?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Benson, to your comment, the database does serve for research purposes. You know, when you are looking at cancer cluster, the mesothelioma study being one of those. But there were other studies that are currently being done with. Sometimes we get grants to be able to look specifically at specific employer or specific geography. We're just concluding one in northeast Minneapolis around an old plant that was now a Superfund site, and looking at vermiculite, for instance. So we continually try to do that. And when we do that, we go we'll knock on doors and we'll be very, you know, with permission, we go as deep as we can go. We find previous owners of homes. We try to go as deep as we can go in each research project and get all the information we need. The problem with collecting it ongoing statewide on a voluntary basis is that isn't the depth that you need to really get at issues. We would still need to do this additional research. I think and I'm not saying what Senator Eaton wants in her bill either, but since she talked about the health department, I'll talk about the bill a little bit. But I think it is to say, would there be tips? You know, would we see something additional if we had general information around employers or employment history, perhaps? That's the question. And we don't think that until you go deep, you can't do that. So it's just a difference of approaches. We think this is, for the cost and involvement, not going to give us the results. We do believe, however, and we are very much in need to do these special studies where we do go in and look at specific things. There are pieces out there that we know about that we would like to investigate further. And we would be coming to you to say, we'd like funding for this. Right now, a lot of that money comes from federal funding or other grants. We don't have that type of a relationship. And so perhaps we need to do a better job of making this whole cancer reporting system and the work that we're doing more visible to you, and bringing these studies forward and showing you these. It's something we realize increasingly that we're not doing a good job of.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too agree with Senator Benson, and that was my question also, is basically what are we, you know, where is this information going afterwards? I guess my question to you, Senator Eaton, is what is, or to the departments, what is the relationship with the American Cancer Society? Are they doing this type of research? Is it going to be succinct with the departments? I mean, why should we have two separate vehicles doing the same research? And into the point of the mesothelioma, my father did die from mesothelioma. He was an industrial insulator. So we know where that was. But when you talk about that disease, it was an 80-year-old woman who was born and raised and died on her farm site, never worked outside the home, died from mesothelioma. Now, that's kind of interesting, and it was from the shingles. But, you know, that's a whole other beast on its own, mesothelioma. And that, I think that's actually one of the biggest health issues that we have coming down the pipeline, because it sits there and festers for years. but I would like to see it in coordination with some of the other groups that are doing data collection and not just putting the department out on its own data collecting. So that's kind of a lot up there. But
I don't really
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't represent the American Cancer Society, and I don't know what they're collecting at this time. I do know that they support this bill, and it's one of the reasons I'm carrying it.
But, Mr. Chair,
Senator Eaton,
would you agree, though, that it should be a coordinated effort going forward instead of having everybody collecting their own information and not quite?
Mr. Koppel?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, we are the ones that collect the data. So the Cancer Society does not collect additional data. And so the database is at the Department of Health. And we do put out a joint report every 2 years with the Minnesota Cancer Society about cancer and, you know, findings, et cetera. So there's coordination, but in terms of the collection of data, this would be specific to the Department of Health, all of those activities.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps, Senator Eaton, you can help me understand what type of data this is. I don't understand the cancer reporting system. So if a doctor encounters someone with cancer, diagnoses it, would they then, for that individual, do a survey, ask them all their occupations, dates, places of work, if they had military service, and then that whole file gets submitted to the Department of Health? Is it de-identified? This didn't go through judiciary, and so obviously Senator Letts didn't think it was necessary, but I'd like to understand how well-protected patient data is.
Mr. Koppel, are you able to answer that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, the current system that we have is the medical record that comes from the provider upon diagnosis of cancer. We have the complete medical record, and that includes personal identification. We can, this is a very secure database. We do not, we work totally through the provider. All information is relayed from the provider. And this would be additional in our way we track this, is this would be additional information that providers would need to collect to pass along.
Looks like there's Mr. Gary.
Yeah. The kind of information that you could expect from getting occupational history depends upon how you do it. Now, we've done that very in-depth kind of information about occupation, that sort of thing, with tool and die workers, pesticide suppliers, everybody. But anyway, it's very arduous, takes a long time, and it takes a little bit of money. We had NIH and EPA funding to do all this stuff. What I am hoping for is that if you get that information at square one way or another, you know, as soon as the diagnosis cancer is made, if you can get that information about occupation and that sort of thing, that would be very helpful in the long term. If you got information about whether they were a veteran or not, that is also helpful. I offered a plan B, and the reason for plan B is to minimize cost. It, on the other hand, Plan B is going to require HIPAA approval and HIPAA access to the VA database and HIPAA approval and access to the Social Security Disability database, which has all that kind of detail about occupation. It does. And, you know, how you can do this is going to be the question for me.
Thank you, Mr. Gary. Any further questions of members? Anyone else from the audience wish to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 2545? Ms. Krinke, welcome to the committee.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. Usually when I come before this committee, I'm begging or pleading. I want to be clear that this is measured comments, because the way the wording of the language in the bill, it says it's a request. It's not mandatory that providers submit this information. It is a request. So I want my comments to be measured based on the fact that it is a request. Having said that, I would like to go on the record and just to point out to folks that half of our patients in hospitals are on Medicare, and a large majority of those patients are 75 years and older. So conceivably, we could be asked to collect maybe 50 to 60 years of employment history for a patient who's going to be in the hospital maybe 3 days. So I do think there is some burden involved with trying to get from an elderly patient who may have cancer 60 years of their employment history. So I do think, outside of the fiscal note for the state, there would be some collection burden on providers to try to get that information from somebody who's in a hospital or a clinic for their entire employment history. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Any questions of members? Seeing none, anyone else in the audience wish to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 2545? Seeing none, anyone wish to move?
So moved.
Bill, Senator Hayden moves Senate File 2545 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS articles for the finance omnibus. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to vote no on this proposal. I don't think the Department of Health is ready to take in this information. I don't think the providers understand what the requirements are going to be. And I don't see a clear, well-articulated purpose for collection of this data. And given all the other requests for money to be spent, I would say this is not ready for spending dollars yet.
Any further comments on Senator Hayden's motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same no. sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, committee.
We need to recess for about 5 minutes. Don't go anywhere. But I need to...
Not too much information.
Need to take a call, huh?
We'll call the Health and Human Services Division back together, and we are going to take a file off the agenda. Senate File 2267 is being removed from the agenda. So that moves us to, do we want to take Senator Hayden, Senate File 1692. And then we have Senator Hoffman's bill after that, and I believe we are done with bills.
Oh, Senator Carlson?
And, I was asked to give, again, on the announcement, on the record, try to explain the process that we're working under here. So on Monday, we will have a spreadsheet and language available. It will not be in the form of a bill. It is not the 25, whatever, the 74, the governor's budget bill. It's actually a reviser's document that we will have. That's what Council and Research has asked us to move articles out of the Finance Divisions over to the full Finance Committee using. So we will have that language in the form of a reviser's document that will be before the committee on Monday. We will have the spreadsheets available as early as possible Monday morning, walk through the spreadsheet, get the language to people as soon as is possible. I mean, we have a lot of work to do. We have pretty much three omnibus health and human services bills that our staff is working to compile: the omnibus policy bill, the omnibus licensing bill, and the omnibus the articles for the budget bill. And so it's a huge undertaking on behalf of the staff. So Exactly what time things will be ready is a little bit up in the air, but we will have the spreadsheet ready as early as possible in the morning, do a walkthrough. I think, you know, people will pretty much understand from the spreadsheet what it is. We'll have the language publicly available as soon as it is ready. We will get together in the afternoon, go through the language, have the opportunity to offer amendments. I will reiterate, the amendments will have to balance because I need to take a set of articles to the omnibus finance bill that fits within our target, and that's what we're going to do on Monday, and we'll start working on compiling all of that as soon as we're done with these bills today. Any questions of members on process? I can help clarify. I'm trying to be as helpful as I can. Senator Hayden, Senate File 1692.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Thank you for that clarity. I think we all now know what our charge is.
Good. Cut it out. You're being facetious, aren't you?
Mr. Chair, I have 1692, a bill that we have been working awfully hard on with respect to residential caps. But before I get started with the heart of the bill and the amendment that will come there, I guess I'm trying to figure out process. Should I offer the A6 amendment, or should I offer the A5 first?
Your call, Senator Hayden. The A5 being handed out right now. Okay. We don't have the A6 in front of us. So
what I want to do is just amend the A6 is a slightly off topic a little bit. I want to get that into the heart of the bill that I really want to talk about.
Okay.
So maybe
we can, you know, describe.
Well, I'll describe what the A6. Actually, we have someone from the department here, or the Board of Aging. I'm sorry. Just depending on what day you, or what lens you look out of it. But from the Board of Aging here, that will talk about our A6 amendment. Then we'll figure out how to do it.
Okay. The A6. So this is an unrelated amendment,
yes,
that Senator Hayden is offering. So on the amendment, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deb Holtz. I am the state ombudsman for long-term care. This is a very simple amendment to allow the Board on Aging to have a little bit more flexibility when they set up advocacy and protection for people in nursing homes. For the longest time, the Elder Care Rights Alliance has developed resident councils in the nursing homes, and they have basically disappeared, submerged into Tubman. And so Tubman Services focuses on a lot more victim services, domestic abuse, and this will give the board the ability to provide the support that our office needs to increase the protections that we have for people in nursing homes.
Does this come with any cost at all?
No. It is... It's a pocket of it's a pot of $140,000. Essentially, it's the $5 fee that nursing homes pay, and so there's no fiscal note with it.
And right now, this goes to a contract, it looks like, and you'd take that work
right
in-house.
Right.
Okay. Any questions
of
members? Senator Hayden.
No, Mr. Chair. I just think the Board of Aging brought this to me. This is really to kind of help and continue to do the great work that we need for folks in long-term care where the agency that was contracted is no longer able to do it. And that's essentially what they're doing, is to shift that pot of money so that they can continue to protect patients that are in long-term facilities.
Being that this is a somewhat new and unrelated idea, I'll open it up. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to the A6 amendment? Seeing none, any questions of members? Seeing none, on Senator Hayden's motion to adopt the A6 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Hayden, you now have the A5 amendment, is that correct?
I do have the A5 amendment.
And there's an oral amendment that needs to be incorporated into the A5 amendment?
Yes, sir,
Mr. LeBaco.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on page 3, line 12 of the amendment, it should read after line 27.
Okay. Senator Hayden will incorporate that oral amendment into the A5 amendment. Senator Hayden, do you wish to describe the A5 amendment?
Well, Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. I'll attempt, and I'll also bring some folks up to help us have a conversation. Senate File 1692 addresses an unintended consequence of a well-intentioned state law which limits the number of people with disabilities who can choose to live in a given setting, such as an apartment building with other disabilities. Rather than straight-out repeal of it, 1692 sets forth a thoughtful compromise exception process which allows only the best housing providers to move forward. My testifiers will expound on kind of how we got to this process. We just wanted to make sure the committee knew it was important, that we think it allowed that while it's important for you to know that it allows for continued input from a full spectrum of stakeholders in developing the application for an exception, has a clear direction to the Department of Human Services for when they must deny application, and critically now includes, Ms. Chair, I think something that you brought forward that we think is great, a sunset on what on when the department must stop accepting applications. You should also know that the compromise is a result of months of good faith discussions between a broad spectrum of stakeholders, including NAMI Minnesota, ARC Minnesota, the Disability Law Center, the Mental Health Association, as well as individuals with disabilities and family members who have approached us as we were bringing this through the policy process. So in conclusion, because the compromise exception process allows for a choice in housing, but also ensures integration, equality, and quality, we hope that you can support this bill and amendment as we put it together. We also have Ethan. I'm not sure which of the coalition that wants to kind of testify and help answer some of the questions.
Senator Hayden, I will testify to the fact that there was a great deal of work from the time that this bill was introduced to the time it was heard in Health and Human Services, and it really did address many, many, many of the concerns that had been expressed prior to the Health and Human Services Committee. I will admit that I still myself had some concerns, as did a number of other people, some number, not everyone, and that the coalition got to work very hard after hearing those additional concerns. And to the best of my knowledge, they've met the additional concerns of myself and others that expressed concerns at the Health and Human Services. So, I mean, this is the type of work that we really respect and applaud here at the Capitol. It really helps us do our work when folks get to work together and understand the issues that people bring forward and come to a compromise. We really wind up at a better place. And so I really want to thank the whole coalition for that work. With that, any testimony?
Mr. Chairman, thank you so much for the time that you've put in to working with us. And I feel like we've had conversations with most of the members of the committee, and I think we've had a chance to explain the bill and thoughtfully answer your questions. But, you know, we were cognizant that this is a long day and the time is short. And so perhaps maybe we would just stand for questions from the committee.
And state your name for the record.
I'm sorry. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ethan Roberts. I'm from the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas. And I'm the designated spokesperson for the day, I suppose, for the Coalition for Choice in Housing, which is 25 coalition members. It's a pretty... We're a pretty broad group, but we're the ones who have been working with Senator Hayden throughout the session and before on this legislation. And to the left of me is Sean Burke, who can sort of introduce himself.
My name is Sean Burke. I'm an attorney at the Disability Law Center, and I'm not the spokesman for all the groups that expressed concern with the original idea, but the original idea of the coalition was to fully repeal the 25% restriction cap, and that was something that us, along with several other stakeholders, did not want to potentially do at this time. So we were part of the process that came up with the compromise exceptions process that's in front of you, and I, too, can stand for questions.
Any questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves the A5 amendment as orally incorporating the oral amendments offered by Mr. LeBaco. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. On the bill, any further questions of members? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The fiscal note is drafted to the A3.
And yes, I was going to make note. It is my and seek confirmation of this. It is my understanding that the amendments offered, we got clarification on the A6 and on the A5. These would not have any effect on the fiscal note, is my understanding. Is that correct?
I have no idea.
Mr. Albrecht? Okay. Someone from the department able to confirm that there would be no fiscal implications in adopting the A5 amendment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care. I do not believe the amendments have any fiscal impact on the bill.
That was my understanding as well. Okay. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 1692, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services articles of the Omnibus Finance Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you,
Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We are going to go back to Senate File 2679, Senator Hoffman. I understand we have enough clarification regarding the fiscal implications, and we left off with... Okay, we have it in writing now. Okay. It's a little bit more stricken language than the oral amendment we had before us as before. So, Senator Sharon moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 2679. Senator Hoffman, on that amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, what had happened was a meeting pursued after this morning, and if you look at beginning on 1.2, that's language. What we did is we tried to clear up the language so that this became the words no fiscal impact, that it's budget neutral. Remember 2 years ago or last year when we looked at looking at our rate modifications and we enacted the legislation to get a uniform rate-setting methodology for providers in waivered services. This new system was required, as you know, by federal law. In acting, we knew that there were some things that were missing. And what we got back then was an assurance that everybody would be doing this together, because you're talking about a pretty expensive system. But more importantly, these services are provided to the most vulnerable and those with disabling conditions in the state of Minnesota, and our elderly as well. So... the system, however you might look at it, must be implemented as that outlined in our 2013 legislation, and data needs to be collected to identify the concerns that currently exist in the system. With that, we've always maintained that this has to remain budget neutral. And so having this amendment in front of you, by taking out the exceptions, provider appeals, et cetera, the budget neutrality language, I believe, stays where it's at.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. And we have Lauren Coleman with the department to confirm that if we adopt this amendment, there is no fiscal implications to this bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that would be correct, that with this amendment that it doesn't require us to spend more money than we otherwise would spend. We still have work to do in the context of the bill in terms of some of the spending implications, but it doesn't require additional spending. So we still will work with the parties to clarify some of those elements.
Mr. Goodnow, did you wish to offer testimony or just stand for questions?
Mr. Chair, just to answer questions at this point.
Okay. Are there any questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Sharon renews her motion on the A1 amendment. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. On the bill itself, anyone in the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 2679? Any other questions of members? Any further testimony? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves Senate File 2679 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS articles of the Omnibus Finance Bill. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. The work of this committee for today is completed, and we stand adjourned. Thank you very much, members. Thank you.